annual report. We've developed a program. We haven't got that much time this final quarter, and it looks likely that we won't be able to deal with all of the entities falling under the transport budget. And so we've prioritized some, and there are some that have still not submitted their annual report. So we'll keep tracking them as well. But we're very pleased this morning to have the Road Accident Fund. The chairperson, who we know well, my colleague, Jacob Mordice, is here. And he's brought a team, and I'm sure he'll introduce his team to us and then lead us into the presentation of the annual report. Thanks a lot.
Honorable Chair, honorable members, I would like to introduce the members of the Project and Fund, that is the delegation. Maybe I'll begin by introducing myself once more. My name is Veli Mahlangu. I'm the acting chairperson of the Project and Fund. With me is on my immediate right the member of the Road Accident Fund, Professor Caspar Grief. And on my immediate left is Marius Leight from DOT, together with Ms. Rekha Frank. And in the front desk, we have our CEO, Mr. Jacob Mudise, and our CFO, Andre Karnat. Chair, Mr. Jacob Mudise is going to lead the presentation, and he will be assisted by the other members of the delegation as and when it becomes necessary. Thank you.
All mixed up, yeah, not the time. Thank you, Chairperson of the Portfolio Committee, and honorable members. I think we thank you once again for the opportunity to present our annual report to you. You'll see that it's a mixed bag. From the Road Accident Fund point of view, the bottom line is, we really think that we performed as best as we could, but the results do not necessarily reflect it. But we'll go through it in detail and see what we mean. In terms of the way our presentation is going to, the process is going to follow, we'll quickly go through some of the highlights. The highlights will summarize the picture as we have it, and then when we do the review of operations, we'll go in a bit more detail through the results. Now, Chair, I'm not sure whether you have the presentation in front of you. You do have it. Okay. Now, the slides that we've distributed to you, they contain almost all the information that you have here, but you'll see that we've shuffled them around a little bit just for thought process and. So we prefer that you follow the ones that are on the screen, but all of them are in the slides themselves. Okay. So we'll look at the strategic plan, the performance against those objectives as a final point, and then we'll deal with the financial statements themselves. So these are some of the highlights. Net fuel levy income grew 26.3%. from last year. And again, we'll go through the exact numbers in a little while. We finalized 38% more claims than we did in the previous financial year. And in fact, you'll see that in the performance that we've undertaken, as a RAF, we actually have the capability to ramp up the processing of claims to much, much higher levels than we already have. But we'll talk about some of the constraints that are going to impede us in achieving this objective. We reduced the backlog, and the backlog, just to remind members, was sitting at just under 500,000 unprocessed claims. That backlog has been reduced by 23.5% just in the 1 year. And again, we'll look at the details. We paid compensation of over 6.6 billion, and that compensation has risen about 28% from where it was in the previous financial year. Cost to compensation ratio improved 8%. We'll talk about some of the constraints in getting this cost to compensation ratio as low as we'd like to later on in the presentation. But that's improved 8% on last year. And we've maintained our liquidity. If you recall, just before the new board came in, the fund had run out of money. So the liquidity is one of the aspects we look at carefully. Now, if you look at these highlights, you'd actually think that it's a stunning performance. But despite that, look at what happened. Outstanding claims liability grew 11%. So we reduced the backlog 23%, but the outstanding claims has increased 11.8% to 23.9 billion. And the deficit has increased 20.2 billion. Now, it sounds a little unusual that you would process and reduce the backlog as fast as you could, and then you end up with the liability increasing and the deficit increasing. But let's look at some of the factors that are causing this. And we've listed some of the economic factors and regulatory issues that are impacting on what we're doing. As a country, we've enjoyed phenomenal growth. I think the growth in GDP rose about 5% in the past financial year. With it was the growth in vehicle population, around 7.2%. We're now sitting with 8.5 million vehicles, registered vehicles in the country. Distances traveled rose 2.1% to 128 million vehicle kilometers. And these are stats that are produced by the Road Traffic Management Corporation, RTMC. Fatalities on our roads increased 8.9% to 15,393 just in this previous financial year. Now, we've had foreign visitors rising.
Yes,
we mix them around, but we'll make sure that if they're not in there, we'll make sure that all the slides should be in there. They're probably mixed around. Okay, but we'll make sure they are circulated. Can I proceed?
Yes.
Now, so in effect, we are busy turning around an area in an environment where all these sectors are at play. The economy is growing, vehicle population is increasing. We actually are not making too much inroads in reducing road fatalities and accidents. But the other problem, though, is we have foreign visitors rising 8.5 million. Now, I mean, you look at 10 years ago, foreign visitors were less than a million coming to the country. And if you think about what's going to happen in 2010, the number of foreign visitors are going to increase. Now, the problem, though, is that we still operate a system where the benefits, compensation that is paid to foreign visitors has not changed. In the sense that we pay them an unlimited compensation for every accident that they get. We pay them in the foreign currency and on a limited basis. And almost every week there's a bus carrying foreign visitors that is involved in an accident. Now, these are the factors that obviously add to the growth in the liability. And mainly because from the regulatory point of view, there actually has been no change in the current financial year. I know this committee has spent a lot of time going through the Amendment Act, putting some limitations that in fact should have reduced and put a curb on some of the claims that the erotic fund is experiencing. However, the regulations are still unpublished. So we face a situation where in fact we are running very fast, but we're spending in the same place. And I think this slide almost reflects our sentiment. You know, we're trying as much as we can to take the water out. But trust me, until we plug that hole, I think we're doomed. And we cannot do it. The RDF, we can't do this on our own. And remember the holes, the unlimited compensation. You know, we've traveled throughout the world and look at the systems that most of the countries in the world have. They're not as generous as we do. We don't have unlimited compensation. We don't pay people in their own currency an unlimited level of compensation. We're dealing with a claim by Schorsch. We've just been in London about a week ago, just dealing with this claim. And for an individual to claim 1.6 billion, and remember, we're paying in total 6 billion in compensation per annum. We're getting around 7 billion in fuel levy income. One individual, 1.6 billion in compensation. We really are fighting a losing battle, and it's one of those reasons why we can process as many claims and as fast as we can, unless we start plugging those holes by introducing some of the limitations. The system is not sustainable. And you'll see as you go through this round. And by the way, if you look at comparable systems throughout the world, you'll notice that even those systems that are still based on fault, they still put in limitations in the payout of claims, and that's what makes them a little sustainable. Now, given what we have as the Rotexin Fund, you know, you'll see when we go through the numbers in detail in a little while that we have to make a couple of economic choices. We are grossly undercapitalized. We actually have no capital base. We'll see when you look at the balance sheet that we actually do not have any assets or reserves from which to pay the backlog. We do not have any reserves from which to pay the backlog. We get fuel levy that we receive at around 7 billion. And by the way, that fuel levy has been reduced by the introduction of SARS fuel collection system, which has now reduced it by a billion. So in reality, although when you look at the numbers, you'll see that fuel levy income was 7 billion. In reality, cash that we received was 1 billion less. And by the way, all these numbers are going to come in a little while. So if you bear with me. Now, that fuel levy doesn't come anywhere near enough to paying for our legacy, all the problems that we have. So I think as a board, we've had to make a couple of choices. Choices between clearing the backlog and building up reserves. So, and the focus has been on, initially, just on the claimants out there who really have been suffering to try and process the claims as quickly as we can. So you'll see that we have ramped up the processing of claims, and then you'll see in the numbers that we're going to publish. And we haven't really spent time on building the capital base. Because what we said is, let's just get as much cash into the claimant sense as we can and not build the capital base. Obviously, you know, we're busy looking at a strategy to see how we can attain both. All right. Again, a little bit more detail on the background. These are some of the statistics that are produced by the likes of RCMC. You'll see that last year the vehicle population was 7.9 million. It's now gone up to 8.5 million on the slide there. Fatalities were 11,736. Fatalities has now grown to 12,454. So these are the vehicle accidents where somebody passed away. And then the fatalities themselves grew from 14,135 to about 15,393. Now, well, this one is interesting. I think the growth in fuel sales lags the growth in the GDP, and in fact it lags the growth in the vehicle population. That growth is less than 3%, and GDP growth is about 5%. So actual levy income in reality is only driven by the increase in the cents per liter as opposed to the volume, although the megaliters do increase a little bit. And then claims lodged were a little lower last year, but we'll have a look at some of the reasons later on. Now, in terms of a detailed review of operation, and perhaps let's start with the income statement. And once again, it's somewhere in the slides. As I said, I've just put the slides, I've moved the slides a little bit around. This is the financial statements, the numbers that we have produced in the current year. And we're going to go through detail through all of them. If you start at the bottom, or maybe we start at the top, you'll see that our total revenue was 7.2 billion rand. 7.2 billion rand was our total revenue. This was made up of 7 billion fuel levy income. We made finance income. This is basically mainly interest that we earn on some of our cash holdings, interest that we earn of about 237 million. And we've got reinsurance. We actually cover, we provide reinsurance for claims in excess of a certain limit. And by the way, this limit changes from year to year. At the moment, for the current year, claims above 400,000, in effect, are taken over by the reinsurers who are based in London and throughout the world. But the 26 million income is really made up of commutation of some of the treaties that we've agreed with the reinsurers. We look at this again in a little more detail. But I think if you compare to last year our revenue was 8 billion. Now the reason our revenue looks like it has declined is because of this transfer receipt that that was allocated to us in the previous financial year. In total, we received 2.7 billion. And remember that 2.7 billion was actually already spent even before we received it. So it really didn't quite help, because if you recall, the 2.7 billion, 1 billion of it needed to be given back to the receiver of revenue, because we owed them over 1.2 billion in unpaid diesel rebate. And then we had borrowed from our own claimants another 1.3 billion. If you recall, when the RDF ran out of cash, what it did is it went to its own claimants and said, sorry, we can't pay you. Can we at least pay you in installments? And it was called structured settlements. And those structured settlements also amounted to about 1.3 billion. So 2.5 billion of it, as I said, when we had asked for it to be given to us by National Treasury, it literally just came in and went out, because we had to go settle all those outstanding liabilities. And 200 million of it was to acquire systems. And I think this year we are busy, we're in the process of rolling out SAP, Enterprise Resource Planning Solution. But we've also begun to acquire a claims management system. So that's where the money came in. So in reality, our revenue didn't quite drop. I think it's mainly because accountants do want us to show the 2.5 billion in revenue. It has increased. The one thing that I just want to emphasize again is that we didn't receive the entire 7 billion in cash. At the end of the day, what matters to the claimant is what we typically pay them. Now, in terms of the system that was introduced, the revenue collection through SAR, you'll see in the balance sheet, 1.6 billion of it remains unpaid at the end of the financial year. So in reality, we only have had access to a portion of this cash, about 5.5 billion. We'll go through this in detail in a little while. So that's what happened to our revenues, but you'll see that our expenses in fact shot up much faster than the growth in our revenue, than the decline in our revenue. So our expenses grew from 6.6 billion to 9 billion. So this added a whooping 2.4 billion in expenses. And when you look at the detail, you see that the bulk of it happened in claims expenditure. So we actually went out there as a board and said, we will go and pay as much of the backlog as we can. And we ramped up the payment of claims. And you'll see that claims grew from 6 billion to 8.6 billion. And we'll, part of it is a provision for spending claims, but you'll see in a little while. The rest of the costs were actually maintained. And you'll see in the efficiency ratios that we're going to present that we didn't even increase our staff cost by much. Staff cost increased 352 million to 397 million. Admin costs, in fact, declined from last year. So we've tried to maintain as much efficiency as we can within the road accident fund. And we don't have too much infrastructure, so our depreciation was not that high. So the bulk of the cash we spent in paying claims. And that's why it looks like we made a deficit. In reality, that deficit just reflects economic choices that we had to make. I think what we went out of the board and said was, we have a huge backlog, we don't have sufficient revenue to pay up all that claims expenditure, all the backlog of claims. But what we're going to do is eat into our cash resources. You'll see when you look at the balance sheet that in fact we spent more to pay claims than the cash we received. So we had to go eat into our backlog to achieve that. But there's a limit to the extent to which we can do this. And this limit is the cash that we have in our balance sheet. And you'll see that in a little while. And so that's really the reason why we incurred a deficit in the current financial year. Now, just it's slightly a more pictorial analysis of what I've just shown you. Diesel rebate, you'll see that income has grown over the last couple of years. Unfortunately, it's still not sufficient to cover our claims, and that's the nature that we've just seen. Now, the fuel levy, you know, at any point in time, fuel levy can increase more than the REF levy. I'm saying petrol price adjustments that are announced regularly. You know, they increase more than the fuel levy. Our fuel levy is only about 36 and a half cents. Well, in the previous financial year, it was about 36 and a half cents. And it certainly is too low for the level at which, well, to address the legacy that we have. And let us explain it. One of the problems that we have as the road accident fund is that unlike other regulated industry, we do not have an economic model that is used by the like of a regulator. And here I'm thinking about a regulator like NESA in the electricity sector or ICASA, where somebody goes in and applies for the price of electricity, or they go and apply for you know, for price of telecommunication rates. Actually, lady, we actually don't go and physically go and apply. There is no economic model that is used that takes into account the economics of this industry. And remember, the REF actually represents third-party compensation industry in the country. But the basic models that are necessary to govern an industry of this nature are not in place. And it doesn't matter that we are a monopoly. And, you know, and I look at Eskom. Eskom may have been a monopoly for a long time, but it still could go and physically apply for a price. And the economics of the industry would be looked into account, and there is a model that's established. The way our fuel levy is set up, it's not set up with consideration to the structure of the industry, to what the, you know, what the needs are and this sort of thing. And there is that disconnect. And that's one of the problems that we have. And it's not that our fuel levy at 36 cents is high in relation to the fuel price. In fact, if you look at that green line there, it's actually a tiny little portion of the fuel price. And that fuel levy could very easily go up from 36 cents to 66 cents a litre. And it will go a long way towards addressing some of the challenges that we have. And remember, somebody has to pay for the legacies of the past. And either it's going to be the motoring public, because we have been unfunded for a long time. Either the motoring public, or we're going to have capital injection. But at this point in time, we will not be able to pay off the entire backlog unless the levy of fuel is addressed. And unless we actually look at this as an appropriate industry, where we put in the appropriate mechanism to do this. And by the way, there is other fuels, levies that are charged. And this slide, in fact, all it represents is that if you look at all the other duties that are charged on fuel, our levy is actually a tiny little portion of the, you know, all the duties that are charged on fuel. Again, there's a big portion of the fuel levy income that is rebated to industries who actually use the fuel not necessarily on the roads, like some of the farmers who may use the diesel and the fuel for tractors and mining houses who use the diesel in the manufacturing, in manufacturing of the in the plants and that sort of thing. So that diesel rebate is close to 600 million, was about 612 million in the past financial year. I think the heading is wrong. I think this one is finance income. We had a little bit of cash that we received. Part of the 2.7 billion we held in the bank for a little while. And that finance income grew to about 238 million. Now, if you look at, we've been throughout the world and look at funds that are similar to the RAF and said, what does the income statement look like? What is the relationship between normal income, whether it's generated through fuel or through third-party discs and that sort of thing, and other income, like investment income? And you'll see that this investment income is generally a huge proportion of the general income that similar funds like the RDF have in the world. That's because they are fully funded funds, and therefore they have assets on the balance sheet. And generally those assets are managed and are invested through mandates, whether through through the stock market and that sort of thing. And this is a portion of income that generally is much higher because they operate like a fund, a fully funded fund. With us, this is just to be kind of the fuel levy income. It's not the result of a specific brilliant strategy that we follow, because remember, up to now, our strategy has not been to build up an asset base, because we have huge constraints in unprocessed claims, in the backlog of claims. So this was just a quirk in the sense that we had an additional 2.7 billion, and it took us a couple of months to pay out, to pay it over across to claimants. But this is one area where we're going to want to look at in the future. Now, again, our expenses, if you look at the proportion, and we've already looked at that 9 billion that we spend, you'll see that we actually are still spending a big portion on claims and very little on our head office costs and administration costs and stuff like that. Now, I think it's interesting to break down the claims expenditure. Remember, we said it's about 8 billion that we pay in claims. If you look at the makeup of that 8 billion, 6 billion was a cash payout that we made to claimants, so cash payout. It was 5 billion in the previous year. We actually paid 6.6 billion in the current year in claims. But the provision for spending liability increased from 1.3 billion to 2.5 billion. Again, some of the reasons is we haven't started curbing some of the liabilities that arises from accidents, from foreigners, and those sort of, in effect, the amendment like this is not in place. So, you know, we can work as fast as we can. This one will continue to increase. And by the way, this other was just some of the reversal of structured payments that we made in the previous financial year. Now, this 6 billion, we're going to break this 6.6 billion up just so we can understand where it went to. Because it's all very well saying we're paying 6.6 billion. But remember, our system is exceptionally wasteful. If this entire 6 billion ended up in the hands of the claimants, that would be brilliant. In fact, we'd say the South African public would have been really enjoying a hang of a lot of benefits. But you'll see, when we break this 6 billion down, that because we operate a fair-based system of compensation where the cost of paying the claimant is a huge proportion of what we pay out, that it actually is wasteful. And we'll have a look at it in a little while. And maybe we'll come back to it. I'm just going to jump and maybe finalize that concept first. This is the nature of 6.6 billion. You'll see that what actually went to claimants out of the 6.6 billion was only 4.9 billion. 4.9 billion. And 1.6 billion, 1.7 billion actually went to attorneys. Now, this is basically based on the cash that we physically pay out. And but remember, the system that we operate, in reality, almost the entire 6 billion is processed through at the bank accounts of the attorneys, because almost all the claims are lodged by attorneys. So in reality, when we make a payment, we don't pay the claimant directly. So the claimant doesn't actually get the cash. In fact, if you were to ask us a question, do we as the RDF know whether their money actually eventually reaches the claimant? The answer is we have no idea. We physically pay out 6.6 billion rands. But you know who we pay to? The entire 6.6 billion rand goes to attorneys. And they go and pay across the money to the claimant, whether they pay them immediately, whether they pay them after a year, or whatever the case is, we have no idea. Now, what they do though, is they retain 1.7 billion of the cash. 1.7 billion of the cash for legal costs and this sort of thing. And therein lies some of the problems that we had. You'll see one of the interventions we wanted to look at is introduce direct payment system. We want to start a system where we actually engage directly with the claimant. That's the only way we would know that the money physically goes into the hands of the claimant. And thereby we'll know, you know, that it's actually paid on time. Because you'll see, I mean, you look at the press, it's very convenient to blame the RDF and say, oh, poor management, they're inefficient, even when we have paid, because the claimant is not involved at all, has got no idea that a payment is made. When they make inquiries, they are told, oh, RDF hasn't done anything, and all those sort of stuff. And some of the money would be sitting in those trust accounts. And therein lies one of the problems that we have with the way we've operated to date. Now, this is the direct amount that we pay for legal costs. But remember, we have a flaw again in our system. I think this Contingency Act that was brought in, and it was brought in the late 90s, has actually allowed the profession, the legal profession, in addition to being paid directly, the 1.7 billion, to go and say, I want a share of the compensation that you pay. And in terms of the act, they can take as much as 25%, up to 25% of that 4.9 billion. Now, we know that it's a standard practice that they do charge, because the normal excuse is that claimants don't know the law, it's difficult to claim from the RDF, and that sort of thing. We've just done our own estimate. And remember, the question that we're asking is, RDF, we paid 6.6 billion. Where is the money? Now, our estimate is that close to 1.2 billion of that 4.9 billion that you showed in the previous slide may have gone in contingency fees. Now, in reality, what that says is only 3.7 billion, half of the payouts that we make, may actually eventually end up in the hands of the claimant. Now, this is wasteful. If we are dealing with a backlog, and let's understand why we have a situation of this nature. If somebody gets involved in an accident, they cannot just simply come to the RDF and claim and say, I've been involved in an accident, kindly pay me because I've got a broken leg and that sort of thing. Because it's a fault-based system of compensation, we have put in processes, elongated processes, where somebody has to first go through fault and go argue and argy-bargy and all those sort of things. Not only does it take time, you know, ideally you want that person to actually receive medical attention immediately, because in the end it causes society more injuries if they're not treated immediately, especially those people who do not have resources to have their injuries attended to immediately. Those injuries get worse if they're not treated immediately. And ideally, at the RDF, we want to actually not waste time and saying, you know, why should we pay you? Was it not your fault? We want to actually go and say, you've been involved in the accident. Let's go pay you. And in fact, pay the hospital, pay your compensation. We start getting involved in all sorts of these arguments. Now, not only do they take time, you'll see that it takes, you know, on average 4 to 5 years to process a claim because of the legal system. But it's costly. And here's the cost. And remember, if we just introduced an overall system of compensation, all these costs would actually reduce substantially. And in fact, you could start funding the payout of, you know, of claims out of this. And remember, it's just under 3 billion that would suddenly become available and that would go to the claimant. And that's one of the flaws in the system of compensation. That's why we're saying it really is not sustainable and it is wasteful.
Particularly the contingency fee issue, just so that we're clear, basically lawyers, personal injury lawyers, would put up money for someone who they bet, who they think has a good claim against the RDF, would put up funding to enable them to access a private hospital, see a specialist and so on. And this is the contingency amount carried by the law firm in question and then claimed. Now, this 25% that the Contingency Act enables them to claim, 25% of what? Of any claim, or 25%? Yeah.
There's actually two pieces of legislation. Maybe let's start with the RDF Act itself. Our Act actually says that as the RDF, we can pay, in fact, we pay party-to-party costs. So if a claimant comes and claims from the RDF, in reality, we don't just pay their legal fees. We have to pay the fees of the experts, the medical reports, all the fees that are required to be carried by, that will be incurred by the claimant in processing the claim. So our act, that's the one point, and that's quite apart from the contingency. So in reality, the claimant actually really has, when I say nothing to lose, other than the fault-based system, technically, we actually are guaranteeing paying the amount anyway. Where the contingency comes in is a piece of legislation that we borrowed from the Americans, because it doesn't really have a history in our own Roman Dutch law and that sort of thing. We borrowed this success fee from the Americans. It's actually called the Contingency Act, which allows, in effect, lawyers, in addition to paying their normal lawyer legal fees, the normal legal fees that they would charge on scales or per hour or whatever the case, to say, we will take a portion of the compensation. A portion of the compensation. And that's quite apart from the fact that they have paid for a medical legal report. No, no. What it says is, if the RDF goes and pays you 500,000 rand 500,000 rand in loss of income, we want a percentage of the 500,000 rand, and it is not related to whether they have paid for a report. And that report may have cost 200,000, or sorry, not 200,000, 200 rand, or whatever the case is. So it's not quite related to the actual expense. It's a success fee. It's an incentive, which is a success fee, and because in reality, it actually should actually have no place to play in third-party compensation. Because remember, what you're supposed to do, when you take compensation, is because somebody has genuinely lost something. Either they lost a job, or they've incurred medical expenses, and or they maintain medical expenses in the future. I know it's not precise because, you know, you're almost crystal balling and trying to say what other medical costs are they going to have in the future, or the income that they lost. But in reality, we actually should never have allowed the Contingency Act to apply to third-party compensation, because you should never have a success fee. We should be determining the loss of income precisely by saying somebody actually is now disabled, they're not able to have a job, and therefore, because they lost a job, this is the income that they lost for the future, and we should be just paying them that. For somebody to go and take a portion of it, just because, and the excuse that I used are precisely what you said, Chairperson, the legal profession has to go pay in advance some of the costs of getting a legal report, a medical legal report, or experts, and this sort of thing. But it really doesn't bear any relationship to, well, it doesn't justify taking a portion of the total compensation. Especially, and this is the key, especially because our law says the RDF will pay those party-to-party costs. The RDF will pay for that legal, for the acquisition of that certificate and this sort of thing. And I think therein lies the problem with the contingency. It's just a success fee. Now, so that's where the bulk of the 6 billion has gone to. Now, again, we'll come to the volume of claims that we processed. Of that 3 billion, and again, let's go back and have a look at the numbers that we're talking about. If you recall, we started off with that 6 billion, which is made up of 1.6 billion that went to legal costs, 4.9 billion that is compensation and medical costs. So what we're going to break down now is to say what portion of this 4.9 billion goes to what fixing somebody's body in terms of medical costs, what portion goes to the income that they lose, and what portion is sorry money. And this is the slide that actually depicts this. And again, it shows the sadness in our system of compensation. In reality, when somebody gets involved in an accident, physically, they should have had a broken bone. And we should be compensating them for the medical costs. But if you look at the payment that we make in medical costs, it's a tiny amount. Only 488 million. So we're paying, out of compensation that we paid, remember we said we spent 6 billion. Only 500 million went to what's fixing that person's body, whether it's a broken leg or whatever the case is. But look at where the bulk of the case has gone to. General damages. That action, sorry, money. And this is where, again, where the Amendment Act would have really kept this to and limited it to serious injury. And 2.6 billion going towards sorry money really is, again, is wasteful. And 1.7 billion has gone to loss of income. So I think the message again from this is that had we had the Amendment Act in place, where we limited the payout of general damages only to circumstances where somebody was seriously injured. Trust me, the bulk of this 2.6 billion would have been reduced to close to nothing. And you'll see when you look at the volume of the claims, most of our claims actually, in terms of volume, happened in this sector here. It's tiny little things of 50,000. So somebody gets involved in a bumper dashing accident. And generally, there is almost zero claim for medical costs because they really are not injured. And but they'll say, oh, my neck is sore, whatever the case is, and then claim a big sum in general damages. And again, that's one of the problems that we have in our system of compensation. And perhaps we'll look at the volumes in a little while. One of the things that the RDF also issues is something called an undertaking. And an undertaking is almost like a medical aid. As opposed to paying somebody cash for what they feel they're going to spend in medical costs in the future, we give them a certificate that we say to them, they can use either for the rest of their lives to get medical attention. In total, we have issued 81,000 of those college medical certificate undertakings, but only 2,000 of them are active, 2,300 of them are active. Now, there's one or two, potential reasons for this. Either the persons were not really genuinely injured. In fact, it's probably better to pay, to issue an undertaking rather than to pay a lump sum. But we have to accept, though, that the fair-based system of compensation also introduces its own problems, in the sense that where somebody has to make a co-payment, some people may not afford to do so. So because it's fair-based, if we assess, say, the merit of the case as the individual being 50% at fault, every time the undertaking is also written in the same manner. So every time you go to get medical attention, you also pay your own 50%. However, the reasons why it is not utilized is because the people are not really genuinely injured. But it still is valued in the outstanding liability. And in fact, if you look at the cash amount, we only pay per annum 59 million. And undertakings have not increased over the past couple of years. Only 50 million. Remember, we're spending 6 billion and 60 million we spend for people coming in to claim for future medical costs. It's a tiny little amount. Now, let's go back and look at the volumes of claims. At the end of the previous financial year, we had total outstanding claims of 145,000 claims. And that was the backlog. This is what we generally define as the backlog. That backlog has dropped significantly to 341,000 claims. So in effect, the claims that we processed grew from 188,000 in the previous financial year to 260,000. So I think from the RDF point of view, we really went out of our way to try and process as many claims as we can to deal with the backlog. I mean, the increase from the previous year, from 2005 to 2006, was remarkable on its own. But you can see that you process a lot more claims. And that's one of the reasons why the backlog reduced substantially. Now, in terms of the makeup of the backlog that we reduced, you'll see that we have two types of claims, supplier claims. These are hospitals and ambulance groups, and those are the people who are allowed to claim directly from us. And non-supplier claims, and these are just normal claimants that we pay. The bulk of the area where we made the impact was in paying back most of the supplier claims, hospital claims, but we also made significant inroads in non-supplier claims, and these are the normal, individual claims. Now, this is the distribution of claims that we spoke about. It hasn't changed. The bulk of our claims, in fact, if you add claims below 50,000 rand, this is where the bulk of our claims are. Most of our claims are tiny little claims. Tiny little claims where somebody is not really injured and they claim general damages. then, you know, and they clog our system. And amendment like we have gone a long way towards reducing this. This is another pictorial representation of this. On this slide, we show the number of planes in terms of volume. At the bottom, we show the size of the plane from a claim of less than 1,000 to 50,000 and the total compensation we pay. You'll see that most of the compensation that we pay arises out of the small little planes, which are soft tissue planes and that. So that hasn't changed. Right. So let's actually just present the picture of what we've done. So as the RAF, we really have done as much as we can. As much as we can to reduce the claim, to reduce the backlog. Although the outstanding liability has continued to increase. But these are some of the steps that just indicate that average notification is still around 12 months. So it takes about 12 months for people to tell us that they've been involved in an accident. One of the things that we have done as a RAF is we've tried to pay out as many of those old outstanding claims as we can when we're looking at the backlog. So the average age of the claims that we settled actually increased a little bit because we wanted to go and clear as many of those old claims as we can. But we still have pretty old claims in our system, you know, that have been processed. You know, in a period of over 60 months. Settlement amounts. Remember, the economy is growing. You know, general income levels have been increasing and that sort of thing. What we've kicked up is that the average settlement amount has also increased to over 35,000 in the current financial year. And but claims in excess of 500,000. Are still a small proportion of total claims. It's only 1.54% of claims are over 500,000. So it's only a few people who really make very, very large claims. And primarily foreigners, you know, I think South Africans generally, you know, claim the soft tissue claims where they are not really genuinely injured. All right? The problem with foreigners, again, is reflected in the provision for outstanding claims. And by the way, you'll notice, though, that the figures do not add up to over a billion rands. And that's because what we do is we provide our own estimate of the present value of some of those foreign claims. So there is a claim, for instance, from Shosh in excess of 1.7 billion or 1.6 billion. But in terms of proportion, foreign claims are a huge proportion of our large claims, of all claims in excess of 5 million. You'll see then it's gone to just under 80%. So again, had we introduced the limit to the 150,000 limit with Amendment 8, this figure would have reduced quite substantially. And remember, we're the only country where we're saying you can go get medical attention anywhere in the world. You can go to Switzerland, even the Swiss, who's claiming 1.6 billion. He went throughout the world and said he wants the most expensive medical attention he can get anywhere in the world, at whatever cost. And we pay every single cent of it, and in that currency. Not in South African rand, in their currency. So if they go spend in dollars, we pay them in dollars. If they go spend in Swiss francs, we pay them in Swiss francs. And it's a problem. And we really, as a developing country, we are exceptionally generous when it comes to how we treat foreigners. The only problem, though, is the volume of foreigners is increasing. Come the World Cup, we're going to have a problem. I mean, you go through the airport, you'll see that we actually cannot cope with the number of visitors that are coming through the country. I mean, ACRA is estimating that there'll be close to 40 million. I mean, they're talking big numbers. Now, unless we start putting some of the limitations, this fund will continue to suffer. And we can process as many claims as we can, but we have to fix the model. We haven't increased our staff complement. Remember what I said with the cost is that we maintained our cost as low as we can. So our staff complement is still sitting at around 1,700 staff members. So it's just marginally decreased from last year. but we really ramped up productivity, because what we did is we used the same number of staff members to process an increased number of claims. So the claims productivity really rose substantially in the financial year. So we processed more claims using the same staff complement. And that's why the average claims analyzed per staff member rose as sharply as it did. Cost to compensation ratio, we've already covered this a little bit. Again, it's a wasteful system. We've been able to reduce the costs that really are within our control. But we've reduced cost to compensation ratio from 48% to 44%. Again, the bulk of the improvement was in RES own costs, which declined from 13% to 10%. Legal and excess costs as a percentage of compensation has stayed almost the same. And claimant legal costs have declined. So this is the amount that RES pays to its own panel attorneys. Right. Now, in terms of the balance sheet, it's important just to see what their financial position is and why we're saying it's still technically insolvent. And just a quick review of our balance sheet, you'll see that our cash reserves, cash and cash equivalents, dropped from 3.7 billion to 2.4 billion in the current financial year. Again, what I had said is we paid more claims than the full levy income that we received. So we ate into our cash resources. Now, this is the figure that is owed to us by SARS. They owe us 1.5 billion. So in reality, although we say we received 7 billion in full levy income, 1.5 billion of it we did not physically receive. And that's sitting in income receivable of 1.5 billion. We own very little property. A normal fund generally will have a big element here of investments that are managed that are supposed to cover the liability. Now, we are an unusual operation in the sense that we don't have investments on asset base that covers the liability that we have. And we'll talk about the liability in a little while. So the only asset we have is a building that we have in Pretoria that at fair value is sitting at about 150 million. So we really have no assets as a Rogerson fund. But if you look at our liability, the portions of our liability, the biggest liability we have on our balance sheet is the provision for outstanding claims. And it does that we break it down into long-term and short-term. And that's the 23 billion that we're talking about. That's the liability that we have as the RAF. The rest of the creditors are really small, so they're not significant. Now, this liability is established or valued by actuaries, and we'll just quickly go through how the actuaries look at it. But before we do that, just a couple of things to look at. A normal business, what you do is you look at your current assets of 4.4 billion and you look at your current liabilities. In effect, these are assets that you can use as quickly as you can to pay your claims or your short-term creditors. And these are your short-term creditors. In a properly operating business, the current asset should exceed your current liabilities, because then you are illiquid. If your current liabilities exceed your current assets, then we say you've got liquidity issues. And before the creditors said tomorrow, pay me, you won't have cash to pay them. And that's one of the problems. The one thing, though, is that the big portion of it is really claimants and 5 billion of it. So we haven't quite addressed the liquidity, the liquidity of the fund. Although we manage our cash, we won't run out of cash because we manage our treasury activities are designed to manage our cash flows properly. But that means we cannot actually pay the claims as quickly as we'd like to. And we say we're technically insolvent because our total net assets are sitting at 20 billion. And driven mainly by this increase in the provision. And for factors we've explained. This is just a graphical depiction of what I've just said. Just quickly, just to go through how the actuaries look at the outstanding claims the outstanding liability. What they do is they look at claims that are reported to date. So you'll see that the claims that are sitting in our system, these are the number of claims. They actually look at the claims that have been reported that are sitting within the fund. But in addition to that, they add what is called IBNR, incurred but not reported. So that because our system gives claimants right up to 21 years, in fact, to lodge a claim if you're a minor. In most cases, you've got up to 3 years to lodge a claim. But if you're a minor, you can lodge, you know, and right up to the age of majority. Those are accidents that have happened where somebody has not lodged a claim. So they take that into account when they do evaluation of the outstanding liability. And it's called IBMR. And that's the profile of those claims. And then what they do is obviously they estimate how much it's going to cost for each accident year, how much we're going to pay for each accident year. And it's when they add all of this up that they come with the liability. So, for instance, they're saying for the 2007 accident year, you know, it's going to cost us over $7 billion in terms of payout for accidents of that year. For accidents of 2006, it's going to be $6 billion and that sort of thing. And this is how they come to the outstanding liability. I don't know what happened here. So they actually do evaluation. The blue is in, well, the, whatever color this is, the blue is in nominal terms, and this color is in present value terms. In effect, on present value, all they're saying is, what is it in today's money terms? So, in effect, what they're saying for accidents that have happened in 2007, although we're going to pay over $7 billion in the future, in today's money terms, because it takes us on average, you know, 4 to 5 years to pay the claims, present value-wise, it's only about, you know, 5.3 billion. But they add up all of these. You'll see there's also amounts relating to claims going back a long time. So they add up all of these to come up with an outstanding liability. By the way, they do the same thing with the undertakings. So they do an estimate of the active undertakings and undertakings that, again, are inactive, and the ones that would arise from IBNR incurred but not reported. They do a profile of those undertakings. And similarly, they do an estimate of how much it's going to cost for us to have those undertakings in the system, both in nominal terms and in present value terms for each accident year. And that's how the liability of $23 billion is established. So the liability is established with regards to I think the accident that are occurring, but also the outstanding liability, the backlog of claims that we have in the system. The only problem though is, you know, we can process the claims as fast as we can. This liability has not been increasing because we haven't changed the model. We haven't started introducing the Amendment Act and some of those modifications to start limiting this liability. And these are just the final slides. We had set up, in terms of strategic plan, some targets that we needed to achieve. I think it's pleasing to know that, you know, we were able to achieve more than 99% of those targets. But a lot of the targets relating to introducing building new systems, reducing cost to compensation ratios, you know, some of the socio-economic factors. I think as the area, we one of the employment equity is one of the, I think one of the best around. You'll see in the figures that we're going to show you. In terms of both gender and previously disadvantaged individuals, we do employ some disabled and DEA procurement. We've obviously made sure that we achieve some of those social and economic objectives. And in fact, if you look at the staff complement, and maybe let's look at this in percentage terms, you'll see that in terms of applicants in total, made up 66% of our staff. But if you add the color population and the Indian population, you see that we're sitting, that's about 76. we're sitting at over 80% previously disadvantaged individuals in their fund. But I think what is also interesting is the number of females. You know, of the Africans, 33% are female, and 6%, in fact, we've got more females in the fund than we have males. So I think in that regard, there's a lot that we've done. I think what we need to do is obviously fix it at executive level. So we'd like to dilute more females right at executive level. But we've made some serious inroads in this regard. And Chair, then, you know, I'd like to just stop there with the presentation and then maybe take questions.
I thank you for an excellent report. We also had the chance, of course, you were one of the well-performing annual report tables, and you got your annual report in well in time. So thanks for a very competent report from your side. That's appreciated. I think you've signaled to us, competent doesn't mean that all is well.
Yeah,
I mean, part of the competence is precisely you are quite boldly highlighting some of the big challenges that we've collectively got on the front of the Road Accident Fund. There are a lot of things that have come up, but obviously the coming care package. The one is the fact that the regulations and the Amendment Act, over which we sweated and shed blood and tears, I think often in this very venue, and which we completed 2 years ago, remains unpublished and not in place. And I mean, I think that is of great, great concern. So what I'd like to suggest is let's begin there. And I think the Department of Transport, who are here as well, might be also able to give us some report as to what's the problem there. So let's spend a bit of time on that. I think that's absolutely essential. Then I think some things that we've heard before, we need to get to the no-fault system somewhere along the line. We know there's a commitment from the side of Cabinet to move in that direction. But again, we need to ask what's happening. You know, the statutory commission, SAT, I forget when it completed its work, it must have been around 2002. Agreement in principle from Cabinet about the no-fault thing, but where are we on that? And then I think some more specific things, some of which were a little bit new for me, which I found interesting, like the model around the fuel levy issue, and that we don't have a NERSA or an ECAS. I think that's an interesting and an important thing. The direct payment issue, last year you said you were going to move to it, clearly not being able to the extent, or very, very much to the extent. So there are a number of things. Can we start with looking at the why isn't the Amendment Act operational? And then get on to some of the others. But Benfer, you want to say, I mean, for the moment, you want to table something, or you've got your hand up, so let me hear what it is that you want to say.
Just to do this at quick time, because I want to raise a
question. On what?
On issues that have been
raised. Okay. Can we, what I was suggesting...
You need to raise the question exactly on the issue that you're saying.
On the Amendment Act?
Yeah.
Okay. Well, let's begin there. So, before we open up with questions, let's ask for an input from the department. Let's hear what their understanding is of why it's not operational. And I think Marius is the best place to tell us.
Thank you, Jay. Thank you, members. I'm going to deal with it in two phases. I'll just give you the background up until where we are right now, the current situation, and then I'm going to pass on to Rieka, who is from the legal department, just to bring the House up to date of exactly what is the other curveballs that we are experiencing right now. As you are aware, the Amendment Act and the regulations, there's a link between the two. We start off with the Amendment Act, and we promulgated the governance sections in that Act. Then the remaining parts of the Act, of the Amendment Act, relating to the tariffs, we didn't promulgate, and the reason for that was the regulations. Then I think during my last feedback, I indicated that the Department of Transport finalized the regulations. There was only one outstanding part, and that was a legislative requirement
That was on the consultation between the Department of Transport and the Department of Health. Now, I think that is one of the key things that we need to finalize. The Department of Transport, the Minister of Transport, did consult with the Minister of Health last week. The outcome of that consultation is yet not clear to myself. But I think that is the key thing. We need to get a written response from the Department of Health to indicate if there's any problems around the regulations. If that technicality has been finalized, then technically we're in a position to get the regulations okayed, and then the rest of the Amendment Act can kick in if there's not other issues at stake. And I just want to pass on to Rieka, just that she can inform us about the other, call it curveballs, that's coming our way. Thanks.
Thank you, Chairperson. With regards to the Amendment Act, what had happened is that in July last year, the President had issued a proclamation enacting the governance, or enacting actually sections 4, 6, 10, 11, and 12 of the Amendment Act. 4, 6, 10, 11, and 12 of the Amendment Act. Now, those sections of the Amendment Act actually deal with the assessment for serious injuries and requires the regulations in order for it to be practicable. This proclamation was actually issued and published in error. So what the department then did in consultation with the state law advisors was to issue another proclamation whereby the first proclamation was amended by then basically stating that sections 4, 6, 10, 11, and 12 were replaced by sections 1 to 5, which then would come into operation. And sections 1 to 5 basically deal, it's governance sections, it deals with governance issues. However, in August, I think, of last year, an attorney, Marius Kruger, had instituted a court application against the President, the Minister of Transport, and the Road Accident Fund, and challenged the validity of the first regulation, I mean, of the first proclamation. That means the proclamation that actually enacted 4, 6, 10, 11, and 12 of the Amendment Act. And his contention was that the President did not have the power to actually amend or vary a proclamation that he had issued. So that matter was heard in court last year. However, it was heard in court this year. Judgment was given to us the first or second week in October only. It's a written judgment. It was decided by the Pretoria High Court, and the court held that the first proclamation, that actually it was the erroneous proclamation that I referred to, that enacts sections of the Amendment Act that actually rely on regulations to be published as well, is null and void. The effect of that is that the second proclamation, which seeks to amend the first proclamation, also then falls away. So the current situation is that once a court, in terms of Section 172 of the Constitution, once a court declares that certain acts or certain sections are unconstitutional, it has to be referred to the Constitutional Court, who then confirms whether that judgment is correct or incorrect. This matter has been referred. The Constitutional Court has given directions, and they will hear and pronounce on the matter on the 19th of February 2008. Now, the effect of that on the regulations is that unless you have an act in operation, legally in operation, you can't publish regulations that relate to an act that hasn't come into operation. So just practically, we would need that the sections of the act or the act comes into operation first before the regulations have been published. And that's the current status at this point. Thank you.
Thanks.
let's break those two areas up so that we and deal with each of them in turn. And let's start with the first one, which Maurice was reporting. If I heard, I mean, just to summarize what I understand Maurice to be saying on behalf of the Department of Transport, one, that yes, the Department of Transport has managed to find out to its satisfaction the regulation. A little bit vague as to when the department got to that point. Done, except for one matter, but when
finally? Chair, I think the regulations were finalized in June, July already. And then from that stage, we were trying to get the one technical point out of the way, and that is the whole thing around the consultation.
With the Minister of Health?
Well.
Okay. I think the first thing we would want to say... Okay, let's ask a question.
Yeah, Chair, I think we definitely need to be clear on this issue. You know, we can't labor and we can't deliberate, we can't misuse time. You know, it's under the pretext that this particular legislation is necessary to correct certain issues. But when you complete it with the department, then they still take 2 years to get with the regulation. So they're actually defeating the whole objective of us, you know, spending time to try and correct the situation. And as far as I'm concerned, I thought we have passed the legislation on the amendment for the road extension fund, and we have dealt with the problem, and one is expecting the road extension fund to give us a better report on the basis that some of the hurdles they had, we have corrected them. And today it proves as if we have done nothing. That's the problem I'm having. And 18 months down the line, there is no effect of what we have done on the books of road accident funds. And surely, dedication, commitment to actually assist in solving the problems that we have identified, and also the department itself has identified as hurdles of this entity, is not there. Otherwise, then, it's a group of people or a group of staff people should have been committed to actually change this. Even if this is the hurdle we're talking about from the health department. I mean, this is not a hurdle. I mean, if one official there is dedicated and changed that thing because it is a stumbling block on the implementation of legislation, these things could have been done long ago. Or even reported to us and could have found a way of actually assisting the department to get over that thing. Thanks.
Thank you, Chairperson. I actually wanted to emphasize what the Dimashin has just said. That, every year when we get reports from RAF, they'll forever complain about foreigners who are here and who have claimed that, huge amounts. And if we had regulations, we wouldn't have this kind of complaint. We spent a lot of time coming to this world. We're not coming here just to have fun. We want to come here, do things, and we want them to be implemented. And they cannot be implemented if there's a stumbling block somewhere. So we need to go out somewhere. I think we need to give a clear message to the department that says, you cannot wait for 18 months to get the definition of serious injuries and other things. You cannot. It's really not acceptable at all. It means after this, it was thank you so much. There's a law. They've passed a law, and that's it. And there's nobody who actually saying this is what we are going to do, and this is the time that we are giving, the time frame that we are giving ourselves to do this. Because we would have caused public hearing with all the regulations that we came up with, so that we can hear their views and all that. Because for instance, this thing of lawyers. We were actually saying some people out there in the rural areas don't have lawyers. They can't have lawyers. We cannot have lawyers who will be talking on our behalf and getting a lot of money from government, while people can actually do it themselves. But how can they do it if there are no regulations at all? So I think we need to be serious with our jobs, because I think that's what we are paid to do. Thank you, Chairperson.
I can only agree with what's been said here and the sentiment that's expressed.
there's a little bit of concern that I have, and that relates to the, you know, the impact that it's had on this report, which we see in front of us, despite a lot of hard work that's been trying to reverse the situation within the limited resources. But the bottom line is that if there was delay in the regulation process, which I have inquired about, I think, on a number of occasions in this very place here, wanting to know what that was. I mean, there is a basic, I hate using this word, but they call it a meat list that exists within the current RAF, which would have allowed us an interim basis to go out and to pay on the basis of a broken arm, broken leg, whatever. But I think the most key thing here is, you know, what the CEO has raised about foreign claim. In that original amendment act, we argued here at length about the consideration of maybe at least ensuring that the claim was in rand and not in US dollars or pounds. Now, my feeling and my sentiments are that, you know, we've missed a very important boat here in trying to turn this thing around and give the necessary support that we wanted to give to this RAF in respect to that amendment bill, and that is to ensure that we limit those types of payments. Now, the shocking revelation here today of the claim that's taking place over in London at the moment, you know, it just takes away all initiatives that we put in here. And I think that what we could have done, and I don't know whether this is right, maybe Rika, as the legal person, could have actually stepped in here, is that, you know, where we were sort of ringing these and raising these alarm bells, let's call it that, we could have maybe come back. It would have been quicker for us to maybe amend the Act to just satisfy that aspect of it within another amendment of the amendment, if necessary, you know, and got rid of this problem of the major capital, outflows that are going out in foreign currency. I find that, you know, this is actually a tremendous shock, you know, and I don't know how many times it's been raised that we couldn't actually have just come back and rethought about it. Maybe we're at fault, you know, as legislators, to say to ourselves, well, you know, we should have taken the initiative and said, right, let's come back with that bill. If it hasn't worked, I mean, for 2 years, and this is just going to be a continuation and exacerbation of the problem. But I don't know whether that is a legal process that could not even be done right now, is to go back and say, let's sit here, and if we have to sit through the night, let's get something back to just to get that aspect of it sorted out, or even the capping aspect of it. And then, you know, we put this thing on a new footing now and can go ahead, and never mind the Constitutional Court. I don't know whether next year that thing is ever going to be heard. I really don't know, Rika. And I think you'll find that, you know, there could be someone appealing against it again, and there's going to be all this nonsense. I think we must get that bill back into this portfolio committee and try and deal with some of the most key aspects of it which are impacting on this balance sheet here today. I really believe that, sir. I don't know whether it's possible. We need some legal minds to come and tell us and guide us there, but I think we should have done that maybe, you know, when we raised the alarm bells about the delays in the regulations. Okay.
Chair, I just want to check one thing from department. In terms of their timelines, I still remember, well, I don't have that document in front of me now, but they were saying that from March, they will be dealing with regulations. And now I understand that an official from department is not quite sure when this was being dealt with. He says in his statement, he says between June and July. I just want to check what was the reason for them to start between June and July. It's not quite sure exactly. Because in terms of the timelines, it was there that regulations will begin to be worked well in March. Why did they start to work on after 3 months? What, in between that 3 months, what is it that was happening? Thank you, Chair.
I'm trying to summarize so far, because where Stuart was going in his latter part was what I was a little bit reserving for Rika's dimension, which is the core challenge and so forth. But what all members very clearly are saying, okay, first and foremost, is it's absolutely unacceptable that the regulation, as foreseen, as required by the legislation, which we passed almost exactly 2 years ago, have still not been, whatever it is, promulgated. It's unacceptable. If I understood Mari, what he was saying, they didn't begin to work it on June, July, but they were completely, from the Department of Transport side of things, by mid-year this year, they had completed all that they could do on their own to their satisfaction, but there was still the one hanging matter, and that is the definition in regulation of serious injury, okay, which then relates to compensation for general damages. Okay, and that's why Stuart is quite right to separate the foreign claims issue, which has more to do with capping losses, future loss earnings, that dimension of things. The general damages claims are much more South African small things which clog up the system and which also account for a large amount of the money. So they're two big issues, I think. Okay. Now, I think what we're wanting to say is, okay, we agree that you didn't begin to work on it in June, July, but your target, and I think Offensive is right to remember that, was to begin to implement the regulations by, to complete it by March. It was a whole year after, but okay. We always understood that serious injury was going to be quite a challenge. So what we're saying, we're not talking to individuals, but we're saying to the department, it is unacceptable that the regulations are not yet ready, and that having completed them more or less by June, July itself is not good enough. And we can't just blame the Department of Health, although maybe we should, and maybe there is a serious lack of attention there as well. But at the end of the day, making sure these regulations get through, the buck must begin and stop with the department. And I agree with, I think Stuart and others have said, maybe we've also not been sufficiently on the ball on this, although numbers of us, including students, have been raising this matter from time to time. We've always been raising it. But I think really today we've got to say it's got to happen. And it's got to happen, you know, in the next week, basically. The process got to be completed. And it can't be that we complete as a department transport the thing and then wait for... Parallel, we've got to be pushing to make sure that the health department is on board and that the whole thing is completed. So, no more excuses. We've absolutely got to have it. And I think that what we should do, I suggest we should issue a formal statement as this, across party, in agreement as well, saying this fundamentally. Okay. Now, even if we complete them next week, we've still got the second matter, which is the Constitutional Court challenge. Okay. Now, if I understand it correctly, there are two things at work here. The first is a blunder, a small one. It's a matter of presumably what was intended was obviously to enact those parts of the Amendment Act, promulgate them, whatever, that had to do with governance, and leave to one side, pending the regulations, those parts that had to do with the regulations until we could get them completed. And in the proclamation given to the President to sign, the wrong parts, what should have been excluded was included and what should have been included got excluded. So an innocent mistake, one that shouldn't happen. So again, I don't want to do it. I mean, we're all capable of making those mistakes. It's obviously a great pity that it happened, and presented an opportunity for what's a whimsical, frankly, court case to which the individual is entitled, the individual attorney is entitled to take up. But on a pure technicality. Now, all of this, and this was the other point we must make in regard to the first point, this is literally costing the country billions of rand. I don't know what your estimate sounded to me to be. We don't know because it's a bit of crystal ball gazing, but probably of the order of 2 to 3 billion rand. 10 million a day is your estimate of what it's costing us not to implement the amendment that we brought about. And, So it's a small error maybe here or there, but this court case is another one. The real issue is that the regulations didn't come in, and we could then deal perhaps in some way. Now, so it's a very, very serious problem, this this dragging of heels and lack of drive in implementing the regulation. Okay. Now, we can't wait until February, 19th of February, and we don't even know what the outcome will be for 19th of February, and that's where I think that Stuart's question becomes a relevant one. Is there something that can be done? And I don't think that we can answer, we don't know, if we had state law advisors or someone might be able to tell. Is there some way of short-circuiting all of this, which is if we have to amend the Amendment Act by changing a comma or whatever, or passing it again in some form? Is there some technical way of getting around what is a technical objection, which is holding up, which is another thing, it's the other curveball or whatever that's holding up everything. So can we ask the department, please, maybe working with the fund, we'll from our side also ask the question that you might have the capacity to drive it more determinately than we've got. We haven't got that much capacity. I think it's the executive in particular too. Is there a way of making this court process, which will proceed as court processes do, irrelevant, basically? And I can assure you we'll have cross-party support for this. None of us represent personal injury lawyers. They have a role in the world, in the South African landscape. We're not trying to abolish them and so on. But can't allow this kind of self-interested technical gain to be costing us 10 million a day as a country. Can't. And as Parliament, we're more than willing to come back in our research period or to sit, as Stuart said, through the night or whatever, to get moving at least on that front. That still doesn't clear the regulations issue. But to get around this particular technical court challenge.
Sir, can I just check one thing? If the regulations are completed, if somebody becomes serious and handles the issue in the health department, and then we have this amendment bill, the whole of it without selections then being enacted, what will be the significance of this court case that we have?
That's correct. It is still stuck. And I must just beg the members' indulgence here and the chairperson, because I actually don't deal with the legislative processes. I actually deal with the litigation. But in my knowledge, you've got an Amendment Act, which is a law. And just in response to the chair's comment on can you amend an Amendment Act? Now, in my experience, that you could never do that. You can repeal it. You can repeal it and then perhaps, you know, take some of it, just repeat some of the provisions in a new act, but you can't really amend an amendment act. Yeah. That's correct. That's correct. And then just in terms of the court challenge, look, when the Constitutional Court, now they are the highest court in the land, if they give a judgment, you can't appeal against that judgment, so their decision is final, okay? When they do set a matter down for a specific date, it is heard on that day. Now, the effect is that if, for instance, and we would obviously need to sit down with the state law advisors and discuss this issue, but the Constitution states very clearly that if a court does make a decision on the unconstitutionality of any particular legislation, that decision isn't final until it's confirmed by the Constitutional Court. So if we are able to come up with some sort of mechanism that will solve our present situation, and then we indicate it to the Constitutional Court, they're not going to take too kindly to it because they've already issued directions. Now, we've got to respect them as the Supreme Court of the land. And I just think that I find that my opinion is that we may be in a catch-22 situation here, because I don't think we can just circumvent the process and get a quick fix for something that, you know, for the present status of this matter. While I'm sitting here, I can't think of how we can actually get around it. They've already, you see, the thing is that it's been referred to them. They've already given directions on the matter, and they've already set it down. So unless the only way that it wouldn't need to go to the Constitutional Court, in my mind, is if the Amendment Act is revoked or repealed. And that is obviously within the powers of Parliament to do. The contention of Maurice Kruger in this matter was that he was saying that, you see, we relied on the Interpretation Act. And it says that basically the power to make rules, regulations, bylaws, etc., also include the power to amend or vary or rescind or revoke those particular bylaws. And we said, well, the president was acting within his right to vary that particular or amend that particular proclamation. And they say no. The fact that you published the first proclamation, although albeit erroneous, you automatically gave rise to sections within the Act. So those sections are law. Now, the president does not have the power to then go and repeal those sections and publish different sections. And, you know, which is a valid argument, but it can be countered, and it's just a matter of interpreting what the provisions of the Interpretation of Statutes Act provide.
I'm sure you're right, and we're amateurs in this area, but what we're saying, I think, and we unified as a committee, is we're saying these amendments that we, as Parliament, desperately wanted and spent a lot of time dealing with, must become enacted and implemented as soon as possible. Please find a route to ensure that that happens. That means moving on the regulations and sorting them out as soon as next week, if possible. We know that serious injury is a complicated area. We know that the moment we do that, there'll be another Constitutional Court challenge around the definition. But until we trigger that, we're not going to move on from anything else. We've got to do is dive in. And let's do it. Secondly, how do we not undermine a legitimate legal process, whatever our views of the motivations of it and so on, and a constitutional process. That will proceed unless the act is rescinded. But please help us to find a technical route. It doesn't undermine the Constitution, the dignity of the Constitutional Court, or the finding of the that will enable if it means repealing the act and having a new amendment act, which looks exactly the same as the old one. We're very happy. But we are saying we're ready. And we won't take the 6 months or 7 months or whatever that we took last time around, necessarily, because it was a complicated matter. If it's essentially the same thing, we'll move. We undertake to do that. And again, we would, obviously Parliament has its own complications in terms of processes and so on, but we'll undertake to fast track it from a parliamentary side to the best of our ability. So can we leave this dimension aspect of things on that note. Maurice?
Just to rectify something, the member is right. I think in March we were ready with the regulations. But then the Minister of Transport and the Minister of Health was one person. So there was a technicality there also around the, if you can remember, around the consultation process. And I think that was one of our... Yeah, I thought it wasn't easy, but then on advice they said no. It's another... Yeah. Okay.
Chair, I don't know. You know, I was just checking that. If possible, if we can close it very nicely by saying the overall accounting officer, who is the director general, can, with powers invested in you, Chair, can you write a letter to her and indicate to her that we are not satisfied the way things are going? Please. Thank you.
Yeah, I think that suggestion I was going to endorse, because we've got the department coming to see us on the annual report next week, and maybe it's an appropriate time to bring the state law advisor and herself into the debate. and maybe have time to think about that, but we should pre-warn her that, you know, we want to discuss this thing very intimately with her. The details. Thanks, Chair. Look, is there time? I mean, this whole thing really, what we're talking about, really dictates the whole presentation that we've had here in front of us and the implications that sort of roll off it. But is there still time for more questions? Or when you said that, you know, this is the crux of it, this is the crux of it. But certainly, I've just got a few others in here. I don't know, if the ladies are feeling different, they can take me to task. Chair, I just want to raise two issues, and it relates to the Auditor General's report in the annual report, of which I think has got some major bearings on trying to increase, hopefully, the implications that we've always harped on, and that is to make the RAF more of an administrative process than as opposed to a litigative process. And I think the Auditor General raises this issue. And, you know, the litigious nature of the fund is such that we've seen the outcomes of claims which, you know, only 40-odd% of it is actually reaching the claim. It's because of this nature. Now, on a number of occasions, I raised the issue of the necessity possibly to restructure the fund, taking into account the fact that, you know, you're sitting, CEO, with, you know, more lawyers than really administrators at the end of the day. I think outside of the judiciary, it's mostly the biggest employers of lawyers. And, you know, lawyers being lawyers, as we all experience, they want to go out there and challenge everything. And I think this is just a psychological process which needs to be reversed. Now, to reverse that, there is going to be some, you know, necessary heads rolling, obviously, or conversion of those lawyers into something other than what they are, those, you know, that stand up and want to fight all the time. But I want to just ask the CEO whether he's had any thoughts about how to do that, because they are expensive people in the sense that they are highly paid. They possibly getting more in the RAF than they would out in the marketplace. In fact, I know that there's quite a lot of, you know, that headhunting that went on previous to yourself. And I just want to bring that aspect to your attention. The Auditor General does raise this issue of the RAF being, you know, operates in a highly litigious environment. And I think it's key to some sort of a change. The second thing which I want to raise, Chair, which relates to the aspect of the IT, you know, the whole process of trying to get the system onto a let's call it a system that is compatible, not only with the claimant, but with the attorneys that are dealing with that claim. Now, the CEO raised a question here today about this issue and the fact that she doesn't even know whether those claimants are getting paid. And in fact, I have numerous, and I know he's been pretty good about this, trying to deal with those cases of people coming to my offices and saying, but look, we don't know, we've been to this lawyer, and, you know, there's that gap. Now, if a computer system was put into place, and this is why I'm raising it, surely it would be a press of a button to ensure that the particular claimant actually is notified that the lawyer has received 100,000 Rand of his money, which he then can actually go and knock on the door of that lawyer and say, where's my money? Here's the letter from the RAF, you've been paid, and stop waiting for 6 months before the payment gets, because it is absolutely, you know, to my mind is thinking, unacceptable that lawyers can hold money and then still deduct from it, you know, the cost of the litigation. I just want to ask, you know, whether those two questions can be dealt with finally. And we didn't, as we normally do, talk about the fraud and corruption aspects, and if we could just get a brief report as to how you're going with your whistleblowing. And, you know, whether the whole aspect of the linkages, which was also raised about the ID numbers, can be detected where people's claims are actually getting to the right people, in effect. Thank you. It's a bit, I think there's three or four issues.
Thank you, sir. Just to add a bit on Comrade Farrell. How does it happen that the department transfers money to the lawyers? I understand the system is not up to scratch, but how does it happen that you transfer the money and not, you know, not monitor it as to how it has been spent? Because then that takes me back to ask myself as to how then do you, as RAF, account for that money? Because you don't even know how it was spent, so how do you account? And I wonder if RAF is aware of the fact that at times, before you people transfer the money to lawyers actually borrow to the claimants. They borrow money to the claimants, you know, like borrowing my own money from you. And that money is paid back with interest. So I think that's also a bit unfair for the claimants. Thanks.
Thank you, Chair. Sorry. Perhaps on that question of borrowing, I have something. The presenter indicated that they sometimes borrow money from the claimants. I just want to check whether there's any interest paid or it has just been borrowed, and how they go on with the interest there. And then again, another question with regard to vehicle population of 8.5. How does it influence the road construction? Does it influence the... Pardon? Yes. I just want to... But he should know, even if it's not his question. Right? Because the... accident in a way would be because population is more and less congestion. It must in a way influence that. And then the presenter said the fund has got more liabilities than assets, if I listen carefully. But now he says it's technically insolvent, so I'm not very clear how it becomes technically and not just insolvent, you know. Just want to get clarity on that one. yes, I think the other questions have been posed by my colleagues.
Thank you, Chair. Can I help start dealing with some of the questions that arose? I think the first three questions, obviously the first one relates to, you know, what steps we're taking as the Road Accident Fund to amend, you know, the way we've been operating to deal with the number of attorneys that are even within the fund. And then the IT system, which is the direct payment system. And I think some of the questions are actually interrelated. Even the questions that are asked with regard to the transfer of money into the bank accounts of attorneys. And perhaps it's important to just give context once again to how we evolved as a fund, as the Oral Dixon Fund. And it's always instructive to just take us all the way back. You know, the fund actually arose out of a piece of common law, which was what we call the law of Gilead. In effect, what used to happen is, you know, without the existence of somebody like the RAF, if somebody hit you, if somebody you ran into, you got involved in an accident, and somebody broke your arm and a leg and this sort of thing, you could sue them directly. And actually you would get, he would pay you. And the law of dealing established, in fact, arose out of those. And even before there were vehicles, even when people were riding in on horses and horses on cars and stuff like that, it evolved along those lines. What happened, which I think was the intentions were right, but the execution was wrong, was that we came out and by the way, the intention was driven by two things. People were getting sequestrated because they could not afford to pay for the damages they caused on the wrongdoer or on somebody that they injured. So if you were to run over somebody who earned more money than you did, you actually got sequestrated. But the second driver of this was that the people who were injured actually never quite got full compensation, in the sense that if you had a job and you suddenly are paraplegic and you don't have a job anymore, and the person you see does not have money, the result of it is that instead you end up actually getting nothing, because the person either becomes insolvent or whatever the case is, or filed for insolvency. So you never got satisfaction. So what we did is we came up with the concept of third-party compensation, where an entity like an REA stood into the shoes of the wrongdoer and said, we will go and pay the accident victim for what the wrongdoer had done. And that's why this concept of third-party compensation came in. But then what we also said was that the accident victim cannot also sue the wrongdoer. But the problem though is that's all we did. We just took a piece of law, we created a company out of it, but we never really put thought to the fact that we are actually creating almost an industry or a business out of this whole arrangement, in the sense that we never really put into place the institutions that are necessary in operating an insurance business of this nature. And just to understand what the real nature of the business is all we're doing is we're insuring for risk. So for uncertainty, if somebody is walking in the street or they're driving in their car, they are uncertain about what may happen. Uncertainty means they could actually, you may not come home in one piece. You could be injured in a car accident. It's an uncertain event, and we provide cover for it, in the sense that, like anybody who says, I have a house, I don't know whether I'm going to have a fire tomorrow, but I'm going to take cover for it. You take cover, because when the fire happens, it will happen. It's not going to warn you. But what we did, though, is we didn't quite create the value chain and saying we created a monopoly called an REF and our predecessors. They are going to be, there's a full value chain in the sense that we're collecting income, we're charging people for their peace of mind. We're charging for cover. In the past, we used to sell third-party discs before we went into fuel levy. So people paid for the cover. But then there were other service providers that were delivering on the provision of a service, in the sense that you had hospitals that were actually executing some of the activities that the REF were doing. By that I mean, although you're providing peace of mind, the REF is actually executing through other parties like hospitals to fix somebody's body and all that sort of stuff. Now, but we didn't go ahead and look at this and say, what are the institutions that are necessary to run an industry of this nature? What are the pricing mechanisms? What is this value chain? Who gets what in the process? And therein lay the beginning of the problem. We didn't quite create an economic model for this. And that's why the issue that we probably will deal with later on how fuel levy is determined, we didn't even put mechanisms like any CASA or anybody like that, because we just took a law and converted it into a company, as it were. Now, all that happened, though, is that the REF just continued to be a law firm. And by the way, right up to just recently, REF never operated any different to a law firm. Not only did we have the lawyers employed in the fund, most of the previous leadership were either retired judges or lawyers or people in that field. But our own processes was based on law, so we create law firms with evidence and everything else. And all we ever do is we fight, because that's what lawyers are trained to do. There must always be a dispute. There must always be a disagreement, because that's what you're trained to do. And there was no concept of a customer. There was no concept of somebody who is an accident victim. And in fact, we evolved a process where all the interaction happened between our clinics. Trust me, if you ask an average RAF employee whether they actually in their job, whether they meet an accident victim, none of them ever do. All they ever do is they talk to other attorneys. It's just attorneys to attorneys. And that's been, I think, where the problem started. Now, one of the things that we want him to change and change fundamentally, which obviously starts to address your first problem, and is we have to change that. What we have to do is we need to look at ourselves as a Rotex fund and say, in fact, our primary customer is that accident victim. And actually, we should be dealing directly with that accident victim. We shouldn't be dealing with middlemen and all this sort of stuff. And almost talk to them as, hey, by the way. And now, we've developed processes that are intended to get us to that stage where, and we actually define it as having almost less than 1% market share, because our tennis have 99% market share. You know, because they've got all our customers, and that's why all the money goes to them. And our approach is two ways. It's obviously, we want to internally change our processes, including introducing something, items such as direct payment system, which we'll come back to in a little while. But we're changing our processes to enable, to make it easier for the claimant to claim from the RAF in terms of the claim forms, in terms of simplifying, you know, the language that we use and all those sort of things. And actually doing what attorneys are doing by trying to go directly to the claimant. And we also have to change our staff complement and our processes. Yes, while we still have a fault-based system of compensation, there will still be some elements of legal interpretation that needs to be done. However, in effect, a lot of this you can automate. There is no reason, there's no reason why even assessment of merit cannot be automated. It's actually criminal that it takes 5 years to pay a 200-grand claim from a hospital or an ambulance. Because the merit, remember, all the law of delict, all it's a system of rules that they established over the years that says if the car was facing this way and that sort of thing, you know, this is the percentage of fault, whatever the case is. You can automate it. In fact, what students do when they get trained in law, that's all they do. They just get taught what the precedence was by the court. And one of the things we want to do is actually not only automate some of the merit processes, we actually want to link directly with not only the hospitals but the claimants. Now, I have to tell you, we are finding huge resistance from the legal profession in that regard. And our idea, though, is like a medical aid, and I use this example that if you've got a medical aid and you go to a chemist, you just take your prescription, you swipe your card, and all that the dispensing doctor does on the other side is just they enter your prescription. When they press the button, it goes directly to mental aid, and in most cases, it gets paid almost immediately without any human intervention. And there's no reason why we cannot have it. There's no reason why a claim has to go through a lot of middlemen before it comes to us, and why we cannot automate it. Now, our processes are being designed to actually achieve it, and we are starting a new claim system, we're just about to sign a contract, so I can't mention the name of it, which is used throughout the world. Our competitors in Australia, New Zealand are using it, and they're using the same sort of system. And we will link up with not only the hospital groups, also with the claimants. And that's our intention. And you may have seen in the press that we published our intention to do so, because we are a state entity. CAJA, this Promotion of Administrative Justice Act, requires of us to go and publish any of these changes that we want to implement. We actually have indicated that we will go direct payment system. We want whatever money gets paid to the claimant, we want to go pay directly to them as opposed to other attorneys. Now, I have to tell you, we have had resistance and problems, and the normal excuse is, oh, you are denying ordinary South Africans access to the law and all those sort of stuff. And all those arguments, I think the legal profession has indicated that they will fight us. And you can imagine, they're getting 6 billion rand going through their account. The interest and everything else, the claimant has got no idea. We don't have an idea when they ever pay it across. And that's really not the intention of our statute. So we are engaged in processes, to answer your first question, where we are restructuring the fund to initially focus on the claimant as a customer, to deal directly with the claimant as opposed to third parties, and to change our staff complement. We actually not only do we want to automate, we actually just need administrators. We don't want to be fighting all the time. But obviously, one fundamental error that will also help is if we go get rid of the four-day system, that makes it even better because we don't engage in fighting. Now, the IT and the compatibility, we're busy rolling all of it out. I have to say that there's a lot of resistance to it. Just the issue of fraud and corruption, and I may have shown some of this before. We are dealing with, if I just remind you, I know this is not part of the presentation we prepared for today. If you recall, we had said that we're facing two types of fraud as a fund. One of it is opportunistic, and others is systemic. Now, you know, that opportunistic fraud arises out of the weak systems and that sort of thing, because RDF had really not operated like a business. All it ever did was operated like a law firm. We never invested in IT systems and all those sort of things. This investment that we're doing in those systems and weak processes are designed to close that element of fraud. The one that is going to require your help, I think, as legislators, is a systemic one. And part of it, obviously, we were addressing in the Amendment Act. Remember, when we get rid of, when we started looking at serious injury and saying we only pay when somebody is genuinely injured, was to reduce a lot of the systemic fraud where somebody who is not genuinely injured says, oh, my neck is sore and that sort of thing. And then they claim. And that's the 2.6 billion we pay in general damages. You know, now, those are some of the steps that we are taking to reduce the fraud. We do have a whistleblowing system. I'm not going to go through, you know, the whole presentation. We've introduced risk management. We're really tightening up on our controls and systems to address that. We want to actually get involved much earlier in the process. One of the weaknesses that we've been having is that we wait 3 years. We used to just wait 3 years before, in fact, wait for the claimant to come to us and tell us, oh, something happened 3 years ago on Sunday at 7 o'clock. And you have no idea. You go look for a police report and that sort of thing. You can't find anything and you can't disprove it. Part of the fraud was because we are not getting involved right at the beginning. So we're setting up in hospitals and we've been talking, I think to the Department of Health in this regard, so that we actually know about the incidents when they happen, as opposed to wait 3 years. And the sort of, there's a lot of activities that we're taking with regards to fraud, prevention, detection, investigation, and we really have done a lot in this arena. And I'm not going to go through this, Chair, other than to say that we really have thought carefully about this. It involves systems, processes, but the important one is that the systemic one will require your help. I mean, most of the jurisdictions throughout the world, what they do is they force claimants to notify the RDF as soon as possible after the extent of the existence of a claim. Some of them say 14 days and that sort of thing. We say 3 years, and we even say 21 years. Trust me, if it's a minor and they claim after 21 years, to go and find out what happened 21 years ago is impossible. And so that's where some of the fraud is coming. Now, transferring money to attorneys. What attorneys are doing is they've come up with something called, again, if you take it in the historic context, all we did is we took the legal system and created a company out of it. They have been hiding behind something they call a power of attorney. So in fact, whenever an accident happens, and I mean it's happened to me before when the people didn't even know that who I was. If you get involved in an accident, you'll be surprised how quickly you get a call from somebody. We call them TARs. Somebody who says, we know you've been involved in an accident, can you come and see? And they're TARs who hug their hospitals. And they do the same thing. And what they do is they force you very quickly to sign what they call a power of attorney, which in effect is intended to say, we will do everything on your behalf. And once you've signed it, they do everything, and the next time you hear back from them, other than if they're looking for some details from you, is when you get a cash. And everything else becomes a black box. Now, it actually arose out of the way we've managed our claims. Now, traditionally, we've always interpreted this power of attorney to say that we are forced to deal with the attorney from then onwards, and we are forced to pay the money into the account of the attorneys. But we've gone ahead when we looked at the direct payment system, and we really wanted to question all of these things. And we now have legal opinion that says this is not the case. And the basis of the legal opinion is, in effect, all it says is that if somebody is an agent, it doesn't prevent you from dealing with the principal themselves. So if I used to owe money to Edgar, and Edgar has sold the debtor's book to a bank, Fed Nexa Bank, in law, I can still go and pay the Edgar themselves, even if they sell the debtor's book to somebody else, to a bank. And if I pay Edgar, it doesn't mean that I haven't extinguished my obligation. Well, attorneys will argue that the power of attorney says you can no longer deal with the claimant. The opinion we received is that all they are is the agents. We can deal directly with the claimant. And we are questioning that, and that's why we're introducing direct payment system. So that's how it evolved. But the issue of lending money to the claimant is actually an excuse that the legal profession uses to actually go and charge this contingency fee. You'll hear this statement being bended about, saying, oh, no. The problem is most ordinary South Africans are ignorant of the law. So when you get involved in an accident, your attorneys will tell you it's complex to call claim, and all those things, they show you a claim form and everything else. They're saying, you'll never do it on your own. Let's help you do it. And we're going to get this report, now we'll lend you money. Even if this report costs 200 rands, they'll say, because we're going to lend you money, please sign a success fee. I think they use it as an excuse, and they don't go and explain to the claimant that, in effect, REF will pay you anyway for the cost of getting the report. They'll say, because of that, we are taking risks, therefore we want a cut of what the REF pays you. And I think that's one of the problems that we've had. And just the last three questions, in terms of borrowing from claimants and whether we pay them interest. This is a system that it was called structured payment system. RAF had run out of money at some point in time. And what it did to the claimant was that we'll pay you in installments. That system is no longer in place. So we pay, once we assess the claim, we pay them directly. And whether there was interest that was charged on it, there was not necessarily interest that was paid to the claimant. In the calculation of the outstanding of the compensation, interest is taken into account. And for instance, often if a judgment is made, there is interest up to the date of payment and that sort of thing. But interest is taken into account in part of the calculation. Now, the issue of road constructions, we don't directly deal with road construction. I know there are jurisdictions, for instance, we have a sister company in Australia, the TAC, Transport Accident Fund. They actually invest. See, they have data of where the bulk of the accidents are happening, and they use part of the cash to go and improve some of those roads. REACT doesn't allow us to do that. So we don't necessarily get involved in road accidents. In construction of roads. And I have to say though that the increase in the number of vehicles is putting strain on the road system and the accident. And we see it in the amount of accidents and the payouts that we make. But we don't get involved directly in road construction. Now, this issue of technical and operational insolvency, I know it is a technical term. Whenever a company has got liabilities, it owes people more than it has money or assets. It's called insolvent. In reality, in most cases, you go out of business. Now, with regards to the fund, there is a difference between what is technical insolvency and operational insolvency. And the reason we talk about the two is, you know, the word that the chairman has used, that we've been technically insolvent for so long, but we're still around. And the reason we're still around is that we operationally, you know, we're not quite operationally insolvent in the sense that there's always this, at the back of people's mind, two things, that the state may come and stand behind the fund because it's a state-created entity. But our law also allows, the REF Act has got a loophole that says, should we not pay, then the claimant eventually can go and claim directly from the wrongdoer. So remember, all that the REF did was it stepped into the shoes of the wrongdoer, and it prohibited the wrongdoer or the claimant claiming from the wrongdoer. There is a section in our act that says, in the end of the day, should we close doors tomorrow, then the claimant who has not been picked up through the area can go through the wrongdoer. And that's one of the reasons why, you know, we've still been around, even if, you know, we've got liabilities succeeding. I hope that explains some of the questions.
Thank you, Chair. Chair, I just want to make one follow-up to the question that was asked earlier on by Comrade Farrell. He asked about systems, and this is a third year in succession where systems have been an issue in terms of matters of emphasis from Auditor General. And the response that I've listened to, I don't think it's a correct response to say, yes, there are challenges, but what is it that we can do? I don't think that response is correct. This matter, it has been the third year now in terms of these systems. I just want to check what are the problems in terms of ensuring that the CEO, being 2 years, 4 months in the office, is dealing with this matter. That's point number one. Point number two, check. The issue around TAC of Victoria, Australia, New Zealand, what practices are they using? The best practice in terms of fuel levy, whether they're collecting fuel levy, that's point number one. Point number two, whether are they dealing directly with the lawyers, that's point number two. The other issue, Chair, I'm sure it's the last issue now. The issue around claim managers, or is it called case managers? I don't know whether do they call. How many cases are they allocated to deal with that, those particular cases? Because if you check in your page 60, where Mrs. Y, these lawyers have been able to buy houses for her and a house for her and all the stories, I want to check what are the possibilities of the same procedure that has happened in the case of Mrs. Y. Why can't it happen now? So that you leave dealing with lawyers and deal with these case managers, and they follow all cases like the specific case in this case that in page 60. I just want to check that. Thanks.
Thank you. Thank you, Chairperson. I like the way you are explaining to things. You know, he has passion of doing it, yeah. But, Chairperson, I'm thinking of the awareness campaigns. You know, it's good to talk, but the problem is how do you implement that? You know, I'm just thinking here, I'm sitting here and I'm asking myself, everything is done in Gauteng, the office is in Pretoria. If they're going to deal straight with the victims of accidents, how is it going to be? Are they going to have, often they talk about claim managers all over the country in each and every municipality. Like he says, when you have a car accident, they call you immediately, those lawyers and all. Are we going to have competent people who will be there, or maybe in the post office? And I'm just asking about the awareness campaigns. What has the organization, RAF, done? Or do they have programs to say, this is what we are going to do as far as awareness campaigns are concerned? I mean, we have passed the law, it's a good law, except for this and that, those flaws. But it's a good law, and we need implementation. So the awareness campaign, I think they need to dwell too much on that. The claim forms, he says it's difficult to fill. Do they have a new claim form that can be actually be very easy to somebody go tabancho, you know, in my constituents who will be able to fill that up after that person has been involved in an accident or what? Thanks.
Yeah, thanks, Jefferson. My issues relating to the economic model or any possibility of RAF influencing the amount of money that they extort from the price of a liter or something like that. It's what is the problem surrounding that? Does RAF have the capacity to put up this particular model and make a submission to the powers that be, if it is NDOT, and then for consideration? And why are they waiting if they have the capacity? If the problem is within the department, what sort of problem in the department do we have in terms of understanding the reality of this particular issue, that the rate of levy cannot be varied to actually correspond to the current challenges?
Thanks. Because we probably, I mean, I recognize other speakers, but we've identified a number of risks. The one is that foreigners and 2010, and even without 2010, the escalation of tourists. But another one will be, obviously, on the fuel levy issue, and therefore the economic model, is peak oil. I mean, it's a Brent crude oil was touching $85 yesterday. It shows no sign of coming down, and I don't think it's just because the Turks are thinking about invading the Kurdish part of Iraq and so on. I think that those are circumstantial issues, but the deep-seated systemic issues, I think. And presumably if oil price goes up, oil consumption is likely, there will be pressures on oil consumption domestically. And therefore your recovery from the fuel levy, even if it, you know, even if it goes up or whatever the amount, the quantity, growth quantity will come down. We need to be modeling all of these things to have a sensible, sustainable approach to the fund. And therefore I really like your suggestion, well, point, that we don't have an economic regulator in this area, like NERSA or ICASA or whatever. So I think that I think we really do need to be thinking about that. Very strong. So I appreciate it that way. I press on good, but then I had Barbara next, and then.
Thanks, Chair. Yeah. I'll be very short. After what the CEO has said, I appreciate it, but still, it doesn't tell me how you monitor the money that has been spent. Still doesn't tell me. But I'm just commenting, you don't have to come back to it. I just wanted to then check, how does RAF, how do you measure your performance after all the problems, you know, that you have told us about?
Thank you, Barbara. Stuart and
I just got to add on to what was said about the new model. And, you know, the question arises, as you said, about the pressure on consumption. But there's also, you know, the big initiative of actually going into public transport, which might or might not have, you know, better or lesser implications, depending, you know, in terms of the new amendment, which now affects passengers on public transport. But these all have bearings on, you know, what the outcome would be. But, you know, the system itself, I find quite, you know, useful in the sense that it is a user pay. So the more you use the road, the more you pay. But you mentioned the figure in your, you know, your operations when you were talking about the analysis of that fuel levy of considering some sort of doubling up maybe, but it's still not going to take you out of the system of debt where you're sitting with 20 and you're only getting about 7-8 in a year. Now, I'm just wondering whether there's any thought about, and I don't like going backwards in life, you know, but, you know, the old third-party system of tokening every registered vehicle on the road had merit in the fact that the onus of responsibility, in a sense, was passed on to the insurers who took that disc over. Am I correct in understanding it like that? It might be a way of spreading your risk, in a sense, in that regard, and maybe the fund could be seen as the topping up agent for that thing, or acting, or those people acting as agents for you and taking it out. I just want to get your thoughts on that. But there's one thing that, you know, I keep on harping about, and, you know, I always say it in my press releases, which you mostly have seen, and that is the fact is that, look, you've got an increase in raising accident rate in the country. It's gone up 8.9%. What is the actual fund doing in trying to say to ourselves, listen, as this goes up, you know, we're going to just be more and more in the drain. Why don't we look at trying to doing some preventative or curative approaches, which goes to the whole aspect of, you know, communication with the people out there to try and reduce accidents, because the less accidents, the less claims. It's a simple rule. And I don't know, since we were at one stage allocating about, was it 50 million to the Arrive Alive campaign, which we realized was an illegal truck anyway. But needless to say, you know, maybe a lot of emphasis, I don't know what the payoff would be for that, you know, to actually assist in that program of trying to get awareness into the damn motorist who still goes and drives drunk and, you know, ends up with all these accidents under the present system. It just cannot go on. I don't believe you could ever sustain it, and I want your thoughts on that, please, and then I will hold my breath.
Thank you, Chairperson. I think most of my questions, you answered my questions, because I was worried about the middlemen, the lawyers, but you've already answered my questions about the lawyers, that middlemen, because you say they are fighting, you know, and there's no way that maybe we can cut off the middlemen, because the problem lies on these middlemen. Because my questions are based on fraud and corruption, because it's a chain. It's not only, you know, it's the doctors, police, even the lawyers. That's why in our hospitals, these agents, people are staying in hospitals every day because there are accidents almost every day. Immediately, when accident happens, they go straight. If you don't have phone, they've got the address in the hospital. And they go straight to your home and tell you that there's this best lawyer that can process your case, and if you want money, you can borrow money from the lawyer, you know? You know, there's a lot of corruption, but because the bulk of Amendment Act is not implemented, I don't think we can monitor all this corruption, you know? But really, in road accident fund, there's still lots of corruption, and it's a chain. Thank you, Chairperson.
All right.
I'm using my personal experience to recognize at the rent clinic. But what I want to explain practically what my colleagues have said. Like I said, I was in a coma, then I was transferred because I was on duty. Although I was coordinating a strike, but working for Hellerins, then my company involvement in terms of arranging for my removal too. Had I been just an ordinary person at the time, one thing, there could have been a problem, because this hand was just like to be amputated. But you see, when you then come to how you know where to go, from Rand Clinic, the first thing I had to do, I had to go to John Foster Square to get the statement, the police, as well as to the traffic department in Johannesburg, which could have cost me more money to if I had to go to the lawyer. But ultimately, because of the processes, one had to go to a lawyer. Despite the challenges that one faced, or the help one got, was that the case had to be monitored by the employer in terms of my rent clinic payment, which was a private clinic. But I'm explaining here a situation whereby, had it not been for that, I would maybe have been taken to just and say Sebokeng Hospital, where this hand could have been amputated, because I had this external fixation, six operations, I spent 6 months, and then very expensive. But the out of whatever was paid, despite that I got 4,000, 20,000 went into getting my up. You see, the concern is, you never know, in terms of the claim, what happened between that and that. And the only thing I could console myself was that I still had a hand, you see. And I think what they are trying to, and most people do have serious experiences. Mostly if you can interview, if Comrade Max was here and others, if you interview those people who are involved, you'll then understand exactly as to what challenges we are facing. And I think there are many government departments that have to. Jefferson, I feel very strong that, for instance, in our constituency, you see what happens, what steps are doing in order to keep their statistics low. When people are involved in an accident, if there's no death, a fatality, they don't take the case. They say, you have got to discuss between ourselves. Those unreported cases, whereby this goes back to the question of, in what way can all government, including GCIS, that has got resources in terms of communicating to communities, that a cluster, maybe a cluster to discuss how best this can be dealt with and to be taken on board by all. What above all, at a workplace also. And I wanted to find out in terms of how close you could work with, for instance, with CREDA, with the Department of Labor, section on injuries, because people get injured, those drivers, whilst on duty, and you know what happens? It is your boss who will choose to do whatever statement, and then you can't, because they also intend incriminating you in terms of, firstly, is my baki safe rest before they can check on you. So I'm saying, Jefferson, this is something that is so complex that it has to be a campaign that involves all sections which we are suspicious of. And it is really, there are cases, even the department, you know, development are along freeways. I'm not far from Orange Farm, and I can tell you how many accidents you get along. So many people get injured or others are being killed, but it is difficult also because you first have to negotiate with the person who has caused an accident, and then people don't know what to do. Thank you.
So just a little bit. Thank you, Chairperson. I wanted to ask something. You know, people in accidents, they end up being disabled and all that. And that's why, Happy King, RAF will give you 40,000, and just make an example, which in that 40,000 you'll end up maybe with 15,000 because of cost and all that. I'm just exaggerating it because I want them to make pressure and make sure that when the lawyers are fighting them, they have some things to say to them. That, I mean, it's taking, because, I mean, if I decide that I will give you 40,000, it's because I've seen your accident and how far you are injured and all that. And I think that 40,000 will keep you, you know, will sustain you, and because you become a burden to people that you stay with. So it is that will help. But the problem that is there, Chairperson, is that most of these people, okay, some of them are working and all that, but the lump sum also becomes a problem when you are given a lump sum, because you are interviewing a member of parliament and all of a sudden you get into an accident, maybe you get 2 million, but you've never seen that. So obviously, you think you are so rich and you waste the money and all that. Is there any mechanism that the RAF, as part of the awareness campaign, as they are saying that they are taking these things off the lawyers, that there are no middlemen, which we agree with as a committee, all of us, we agree with that. Are there any mechanisms that they will be able to educate people as when they are receiving this money, how can they use the money? Thank you, Chairperson.
Yeah, just a short question. Chairperson, the presenter was referring to the backlog of old claims. I just want to get a sense of how many years back, you know, the claims are.
Right, thank you, Chair. Perhaps let me be the first one first. Perhaps I didn't explain myself properly. We are investing in systems. We are, in fact, as we speak, physically rolling out SAP, Enterprise Resource Planning System. We are physically, I wasn't going to mention the name because we're finalizing contract negotiations. We are actually physically implementing a new claims management system. I don't think we, as an area, we can afford to come up with excuses for not changing our systems and processes. And it's precisely because of the actions that we're taking, including paying some of the claimants directly, that we, you know, we're having a lot of people up in arms, and including the attorneys. So I think it's probably, I may not have explained it clearly, but we are rolling out systems. Now, with regards to some of the best practices with ATAC, you know, we try and also try and learn from other jurisdictions. And you know, we have been to Australia, we've been to New Zealand, we've been to even some of our neighboring countries, and you know, Canada, the UK, and some of those jurisdictions, and we've tried to actually understand what is it that they do differently to us. And I know you asked one or two questions, and one of them was whether they have a fuel levy system, and it's probably related to the questions you're gonna be answering later on, which is the question of whether fuel levy is the best system in terms of revenue collection. You know, the TAC currently uses what we used to have in the past, which is a third party disc. They don't use a fuel levy system, as an example. Now, you know, there are pros and cons in terms of which system is the most appropriate. With the third party discs, it's almost like any insurance company that is selling a product. They're able to vary the product and segment the market and price for risk and this sort of thing. So they're able to actually control how much they charge and how much they don't charge, what the disc goes up for and what it doesn't go up for. The only problem though is it still surpasses the normal collection problems, and they will tell you themselves that one of the difficulties they have is unregistered vehicles. Sometimes you get involved in an accident in the same way that even today, not everybody has got insurance. So if you get involved in an accident and the party that has crashed into you is not insured, is a problem. And so third party this health code weaknesses. I think it's got advantages in terms of the fact that you can actually, you know, price for risk and that sort of thing. It gives you a lot more flexibility. Fuel levy is by far the most efficient in terms of revenue collection. And at this point in time, we actually collect now at the refinery, which means that, we don't really have a problem of bad debt and those sort of issues. So in terms of the cash that you get, it becomes genuinely compulsory. And you don't have an issue of somebody not really covered because they haven't taken that cover. But we've looked at some of those systems, and we constantly monitor and benchmark and look at what is the best. Now, they do deal with attorneys, and I think the TAC itself has what is called a hybrid system. And it's actually interesting to look at where they came from, because their history was exactly the same as ours. They'll tell you that in 1986 they were insolvent. They had a fault-based system of compensation. What actually turned the corner for them is that there was a political will to change the system. What they did is they followed some of the sister entities like in New Zealand and those sort of thing, and they went no fault. What they do say is that right at the last minute, in fact, the way originally, the Australia operates on a federal system in the sense that it's got a number of states that are semi-independent, as it were, and there's a federal, obviously, government. And originally, they were going to go no fault the entire country. And then there was a change in government and all those sort of stuff. And some of the states, some of the legislation that was just about to be, I think, of Labour or something like that, they changed. Some of the legislation that was just about to be introduced, they were just put on ice. But then the state of Victoria decided to go ahead anyway. But even in the state itself, right at the last minute, again lobbying from the legal fraternity and that sort of thing, they put in one clause in the law that still left in there this element of fault that required attorneys. And that is in the determination of serious injury. And I think that, and if you talk to them, they will tell you that they are just desperately unhappy about it. Because it's one area where they're not able to perform, where they have to argue-bargy and stuff like that. And in most cases, in case they pay that claimants directly. I think the best example of where the system really works is, say, in New Zealand, where if somebody is involved in an accident, you just get paid. You don't have to go through middlemen. So what that ensures that you can focus on efficiencies, on how you pay either the hospital and people directly. But we do look at some of those best practices. And perhaps, I mean, one of them, which obviously relates to the question that came in a little later, the question that relates to lump sum. You know, we're one of the few jurisdictions where we do allow lump sum as a primary compensation model. Because it's got its weaknesses. So you're quite correct. If somebody suddenly gets 2 million or a million or 100,000, even if 40,000, it's a big amount of money. Remember, the object, what we are supposed to be doing, is to do either two things. Make sure that we reintegrate that person back into society from a health point of view by fixing the body. But often, if you're genuinely injured, you know, the health replacement might still need to be fixed in the future and that sort of thing. And loss of income. If you become a paraplegic and you can't get a job, and you just get paid in lump sum, suddenly you'll buy a house, you'll buy your grandma a car and that sort of thing, it's gone. And what happens during the rest of your 60 years or 40 years of your life, you again become a burden on the state, which defeats the entire purpose. Now, what we have said, and I know there were arguments even, I think, in this house, even when the amendment legislation was being thought of, whether to take away lump sum or not, and we still retained it. What other jurisdictions have done is they've said, for certain elements of compensation, they will go they will not allow lump sum. Loss of income, they will not give you lump sum. You know, some of the medical expenses and that sort of thing. The only time they allow lump sum, and again, if, for instance, using the GAC, is on this loss of amenities of life, the general damages fund, which is again only paid on serious injury. And that's the only time where they say, you know, okay, we will allow you to be given lump sum. But your normal income is almost like a pension. You know, if most people would rather, well, a lot of people, you hear this debate in the press where people say, I don't want to put my pension money away. I want to get it all now. And well, trust me, when you do need it, you don't have it. You become a burden to the state. So it, those are some of the things, and we'll deal with it later. Now, we still have two case managers. And the number of case managers we have, and the examples that we do quote in the Act. Unfortunately, the case management happens at the end of the process. In the sense that, and it actually applies to people who are genuinely injured. And this is what we should be doing as a fund. And this is what our sister, I think companies are doing throughout the world, because they focus on rehabilitating the accident victim as quickly as possible back into society by fixing their houses and making sure that they have the help that they need and that sort of thing. Now, if you look at the nature of our claims, if you the proportion of case managers to the 2,000 or 1,700 staff members that we have, it's, I guess it's relatively small. We have less than 60 case managers. We still have predominantly, as I said, attorneys and this sort of thing. But they do go out of the way. And often what happens is those are people who are genuinely injured, who are pushed on wheelchair and that sort of thing. We have nurses and those sort of people who do go out and visit them in the homes and just make sure that their needs are still covered and that. So we don't have as many of those, but this is one of the models where we want to shift the focus on the accident victim to start rechanging some of that balance. Now, I know it again relates to the question, and maybe we'll come back to it, in terms of awareness campaigns and what we're doing as a fund. We've actually been prioritizing the way we are attempting to address, I guess, some of the changes that we're making. For instance, with the direct payment system, we want to make sure that operationally we are ready. We are ready to help the accident victim before we go publicly and start having public campaigns. And I think you will see those public campaigns soon. But there's no point in going out in the public and saying, come claim directly from the RAF. And the claim form is as complex as anybody. Trust me, even I would have difficulty. The whole claim form, I couldn't even complete it myself. But the approach that we're following is even the example that was used, where the claimant themselves has to either catch a taxi and go get the police report themselves, go get this medical report themselves. We want to change that. We want to be similar to, for instance, what SARS is doing, which says, you just give us the basic information and we will go and find that for you. We're not going to let you, yes, we may ask you to accompany us and that sort of thing. We actually have simplified the claim form so much that the attorneys will never come to you and say, no, you cannot complete this. Only we can complete it. And we're going to be, clearly one of the things we want to do is make sure that the form is becoming as dynamic as possible and make sure that we can change things as technology changes. People get notified by cell phone. People get notified by all sorts of means. I think one of the weaknesses that we've also had in our system is that some of these forms were contained in the regulations, in laws, which means to change the claim form, you have to go through a legislative process and all those sort of stuff. And we're trying to get as many of those operational issues out of legislation to allow us to keep up to date with some of the changes. But the bottom line, though, is as part of the rollout, going to the post offices, going to the hospitals and that sort of thing, will also include huge, huge campaigns, which We haven't started yet because what we wanted to do was get the, get our house in order. Now, coming back to the economic model, I mean, we've touched a little bit on how the fuel levy is set. I think it's a problem. You know, every time I know the Minister of Finance announces the, our fuel levy is almost in the same breath as some of the sin taxes. And I think it's wrong. We are an industry, we are a monopoly, we have a value chain, we have people who are dependent on this as an industry. And it cannot just be looked at as a tax, which is just announced as part of the, I think, the budget speech, and, you know, in the same ilk as the sin tax, and it's going up 5 cents, or in the same breath as the, I think, tax on cigarettes is going up 5 cents. Because in reality, it supports an entire industry. We've got ambulance people who want to go and make sure that they are able to draw some funding or at least some cash to provide a service to the South African public. We have to have a model. The question of whether we have the capacity to build a model, the answer is yes, we do. We actually understand the area sufficiently to be able to provide a model of that nature. And we can set up a regulator like an ICASA or SARS who we can share the model with and who can actually be able to independently look after the interests of the consumers in terms of pricing. So we can set up a model, but I think the way the fuel levy is set up at this point in time, without really regard to the industry, just cannot work. Now, yes, the model will take into account, you know, movement in consumption, with the fuel price, people using public transport and that sort of thing. And it can be an economic model. And in fact, we do have it both an actuarial and an economic model that we'll put in place, because from an actuarial point of view, you have to understand our business is more long-tailed in the sense that if you look after someone and who's injured, you look after them for the rest of their lives in terms of, you know, the medical needs and the loss of income needs. But it also has to be an economic model that takes into account some of the movements in the economy with volumes and consumption and that sort of thing. The answer, though, is all of those elements we understand and we can build that we have already, started putting together. How do we measure RDF performance? Clearly, we do, again, we follow the normal processes where we have an agreement, a shareholder compact with our minister, and then we have a balanced scorecard where we look at specific deliverables. The important point, though, is that we have to agree on the objectives that we need to achieve at some point, at any point in time. For instance, if you want to clear the backlog, and that's our focus area, that's what we focus on, you know, in the early days, as opposed to building up in other days and that sort of thing. So you'll see that in our new strategic plan, we are wanting to amend some of our focus areas to start doing a combination of some of these items, and that's one of the things that we're doing. But incidentally, you know, we're not the only people who are technically insolvent. The New Zealand Fund has got, for instance, an objective of getting solvent by 2014. They operate on an all-fault system, but they've given themselves the time and said, by 2014, we're going to build up an asset base. At the same time, we operate an all-fault system, and it's a nice little balance that they're doing. And you can actually set your fuel levy to allow yourself to have a balance where, by a certain date, you are not only solvent, you've cleared the backlog and everything else. And the models will be there to do that. And as I said, we have built those models, and we can look at those. What is the fund doing? Preventative measures. One of the ideas that we've actually looked at the fund with regards to our involvement in accidents has now gone way beyond just saying we want to be involved in the accident scene. We have said now that we really have to understand the business that we're in, that in reality we are providing cover to road accident victims, almost a peace of mind. And one of the requirements is we have to have a significant interest in making sure that we prevent the accidents from happening. as opposed to just saying that we only get involved at the time that the accident has happened. We just make us just simply administrative. And by the way, some of our sister entities actually do that. The TAC has got huge awareness campaigns. But they actually do a little bit more than that. They even go and modify, they go and recommend modification of vehicles, save vehicles, and we've already said that they do investment in roads and those sort of things. But that awareness campaign recognizes that in fact, we are, I think we are the end result of the cost of the accident in the country, in the sense that we eventually are the people who pay. So it is in our interest to prevent the accident before they happen and get technically involved in some of those and put in some of those campaigns. So as a board, we've taken a decision that that's one of the things that we're going to be looking at, including van driving and this sort of thing. And we're going to use our own resources. The Arrive Alive campaign, as it was defined with the Department of Transport to date, and it's still done by the Department of Transport, has not been, I guess, flexible enough to look at the different needs. And that's one of the things that we're going to do. Because we've got most of the data in terms of where we can have the most impact, if it's drunk driving, if it is, you know, a specific road, whatever the case is, we want to, as a board, we've taken a decision that we're going to start getting involved a little bit earlier in preventing accidents by coming up with campaigns of that nature. I know the question of corruption and that we touched on a little bit earlier in terms of doctors and police and lawyers getting involved throughout the whole chain. Although I haven't put this whole presentation, I haven't presented these slides, you'll see some of the cases that we're taking go a little bit beyond just some of the preventative measures. Some of the reactive measures. We want to actually prevent the fraud from happening. And the best way to avoid fraud is to try and prevent it even before it happens rather than detect. Yes, we do have arrangements with the NTA and some of the police units to try and address the fraud that we do receive. And yes, we do have cases where the police and the lawyers and the doctors are involved, and we try and track them. But it's actually a lot easier if we stop it at the beginning. And one of the ways is just getting involved at the beginning of the claim process. And I think that the question relating to cooperation with other entities like the workmen's compensation, whether Queda and those sort of people. In terms of our aid, what our current access that is that we will pay compensation only to the extent that the, say, workman compensation hasn't paid the claimant. So if somebody gets involved in an accident and then workman compensation pays, we'll pay the difference. And it's the same if, say, somebody's in a military vehicle and it's an NDF pays, we pay the difference. So that's in our law. But it still should not stop us from actually cooperating. In fact, one of the areas where cooperation does help is where you have accidents that involve where different parties can have access to the same place. And it's those sort of cooperations that we're looking at. Now, the last three questions, and I'm going to try and go through them quickly. I know the issue of lump sum, I've already dealt with, because I think it's an opportunity that we lost when we looked at the Amendment Act. Because, trust me, society, it's better to actually pay somebody in installments than to pay in a lump sum, because you avoid a lot of problems. One of them is this whole system becomes crystal ball gazing. To say, what will somebody become? If somebody is 20 years old, if an accident victim is 20 years old, to say what career they're going to have, what job they're going to get, and you know, because everybody will say their kid or they will become Bill Gates when the naked lame. And a lot of those sort of things you can obviate by saying we will pay you for the loss of income as on a regular basis with the limit. So we're one of the few jurisdictions where we still pay in lump sum, and I think it's an issue. But as to what actually we do to ensure that people don't use up all their money, currently our law allows us to appoint somebody that we call a curator bonus, so let's just call them a curator, which right at the beginning when we pay the money, depending on who they are, although the curator is really appointed by somebody, is thought not to be able to take the decisions themselves. But we do appoint someone called a curator who tries and advise some of the individuals on the lump sum payment. The only problem though is we are doing it on a very, very limited basis because we don't actually get involved with the accident victim. Most of the money gets paid to the attorney. So if you take 400,000 rand, it's gone, and it's gone into the attorney's bank account. And so an opportunity for us to get engaged and say, you know, dear Miss X or Y, this 400,000 rand is actually meant to do these things. Don't go and spend it on buying a brand new car, and then it's gone. We actually don't have the benefit of doing that as much as we can. And as to how long the backlog has been going on for, there is a slide on this. It's actually been building up for, just to be kind of honest, close to over 10 years. I'll show you the slide. It's not the backlog that suddenly arose recently. It's been going on for 20 years. Okay, I think I've tried to very quickly cover some of the questions.
Professor says he's got a tiny, tiny little question.
I just want to check now. In terms of the best practices, TAC's country, the payment, how do they pay? Do they pay in terms of the currency of the countries where accidents happen, or in the currency where a foreigner comes from?
Yeah. You know, we're one of the few countries that actually pay people in their own currency. You know, for a developing economy, it's unheard of. You go anywhere in the world, when you go out there, most of us have to take insurance because, you know, the covers are not only limited, you actually have to pay for your own insurance. And people actually look at South Africans and say, for a developing economy, because we're small in relation to other economies in the world, to be so generous and pay people in their own foreign currency an unlimited amount, where you can get the top, the top experts anywhere in the world, and we'll pay it. It's unheard of. So the answer to your question is not only do the TAC have limits in terms of what they pay out, they do pay out in their own currency. But even our own neighbors, you go to Botswana, who have actually originally inherited our law, and they said, man, this law is not working. They actually have gone ahead and said, not only, before you even go and say, I'm going to get treatment in England, if you're not approved, if that treatment is not approved, their law says, you will only be paid if the doctor treats you in Botswana. If you go and get treatment outside of your country, we don't pay you unless we have established that there is no practitioner in Botswana who can do it, and then you want to go to South Africa or anywhere else. Unless they can establish that, they will not pay it. But we go ahead and do that. In fact, even our own neighbors, they've got some limitation and rules that really have gone a long way in terms of helping them reduce their liability. Limitation in terms of what they do with, like, illegal immigrants and those sort of things. There's been a lot more thought in the legislation, than what I think the legacy that we had. And I think it's an opportunity for us to make inroads and change some of those.
Thank you. came along with him. I think it was good for us.
Yeah, okay, one little thing.
I really do apologize.
Yeah,
just a comment and then a request for clarification. And the comment is with regards to the substantial delay in these regulations, because I just wanted to bring it to this committee's attention that one of the reasons for this, the delay was another constitutional court challenge on the regulations published in terms of the Principal Act, which regulation was actually included in our draft regulation. So we had to wait for the outcome of that. It was found to be unconstitutional. We went back to the draft regulations. We took it out. We got a legal opinion, and we've redrafted that particular regulation, which also led to the delay. It was in excess of 6 months, and I just wanted to bring it to the committee's attention. And just, it was a regulation 21C that basically says in hit and run accidents, where the identity of the driver is not known. In those circumstances, the claimant is to file with the police an affidavit within 14 days of the date of that accident, claiming that he was a victim of a hit and run accident. And the court found it was unconstitutional, etc. And we then, in the draft regulations, after that judgment, reported back, we redrafted, and we said now they've got 2 years, and we've got an opinion to say, well, 2 years will be found to be reasonable and therefore not constitutionally challenged. And just with regard to the clarity, you did indicate that we must go back and speak to the state law advisors and get a technical sort of loophole which we can use to get out of this conundrum that we're in terms of the constitutional court hearing. However, we will do that, but in the event that there is none, because in my mind I can't think of anything, but obviously we will discuss and debate this point with the state law advisors. But in the event that there is none, the situation that we will find ourselves in is that we would have to wait for this hearing before even the regulations can be considered for publication. And I just wanted to emphasize that point.
Okay. Well, let's try and summarize. Okay, no, let's, otherwise we're going to go on and on. Okay. No, that too. Let's go through all of the things, including some of the things we haven't mentioned. One, thanks for the further explanation of why, further detail on why there were some delays. We appreciate that. We all along knew the regulation. However, notwithstanding all of that, we're saying, as a committee, it's unacceptable that we are sitting now 2 years after we completed, Parliament completed, and the regulations are not ready, for whatever good reason. So we're saying it's unacceptable. We hear the various mitigating factors, but we're saying it's unacceptable, and we are saying, and we'll raise it again next week when we meet with the DG, but we're saying publicly that it's unacceptable, and we expect a great deal of focus and sense of urgency and getting it done. We're saying within a week. I don't know if that's unconstitutional or reasonable, but what we're fundamentally trying to do is say it's very, very urgent. We're costing the country $10 million a day. That's the RAF estimation. On the yes, how do we manage the thing? I don't know. And obviously, it might prove to be impossible. We can't do the illegal. But let us be very imaginative. Let us see. I mean, you mentioned the possibility of repealing the legislation and then introducing another one. Now, bear in mind that Parliament also is not sitting for much longer. And although we are prepared to sit as a committee, we would still need to have a parliamentary sitting for legislation to go through. So we might run into another set of problems from our end as well in terms of timing. But let's see what we can do. And even if we prepare for it and we can't pull it off this year, then maybe we can pull it off early next year. And we can't just assume that February the 19th or whatever the Constitutional Court date is going to give us the satisfaction that we need. In any case, we can't assume that. Not least because the Pretoria High Court has found in a particular way, as it is. So let's look at. And if we can ask you from your end of things to drive that, and again, that's a matter we'll raise with the DG when we meet next week. In addition to those issues, okay, which I think we've all agreed are the key issues, and the key message really that RAF brought to us, and we've hopefully responded with a sense of shared urgency, which we all have. It's not just any of us. I think that we need to pursue the whole economic model issue around the sustainability and the fuel levy. I think that's something. Now, I'm not sure how that gets done, but certainly from our side, we will raise that as well within the parliamentary and with others, with our department, and we'll flag it again with the DG. But clearly, the running would need to be made by other departments, perhaps Treasury, I suppose, perhaps Minerals and Energy. I'm not sure, but we need to. But we undertake to raise that issue as a further issue. What we didn't pursue very much is there any merit in looking at the Contingency Act? And let's also then make that a resolution of this hearing and this committee. That, again, we wouldn't be the ones dealing with the Contingency Act. I suspect that would be justice. But it's outrageous that there's a success fee for a compensation thing, that there should be a success fee in other commercial type things, understandable perhaps, but
we could cut it out of our own legislation as opposed to leave it to the Department of Justice.
Okay, well,
we could say RAF Act, Contingency Act will not apply to our Act.
Good. Okay, that's probably the quicker way, rather than trying to persuade. Let's do that. Then, of course, there are lots of other detail matters. Just on terms of becoming more active in the proactive prevention of accidents. I think the committee, but maybe I'm speaking for myself, were never very convinced about the little bits of, you know, money given over to Arrive Alive and so on, sponsoring Arrive Alive to a certain amount of time. It seems like it was very ad hoc and not thought through properly. No one ever assessed whether that was money well spent or not. So I'm pleased to say that you see that you're looking at it in a more integrated way and so on. But I'm still a little bit concerned. I mean, what you're not saying to us is that's going to become your main effort. What you are saying is your main effort is all the things that you've talked about, and that's correct. Don't get a kind of mandate confusion. And what's been very good with this new CEO, and I'm talking to the other members of the board, is it has been very, very focused. And that's why we're seeing a turnaround, I think, in the RAF front. So keep up on that focus that you've got. But hopefully, and again, it's something we must raise with the DG, is, you know, in a sense, the coordination of this and the information of patterns of accidents and stuff is something that needs to be driven by RTMC, an entity that we are quite worried about. That's dysfunctional, and we're worried about that. But you are sitting on a lot of important information, strategic understanding of the nature of accidents, kinds of vehicles that are causing particular kinds of accidents, areas of the country which are particularly times of day, times of the week, days of the week, and so all of those are very important for a clear strategy in terms of dealing with the very high level, unacceptably high level of accidents in our country. But hopefully that we need to. RTMC needs to be tapping into you guys as well, insofar as it's the key entity responsible for developing and refining ongoing strategy for the prevention of accidents. Those are just a few, and there are lots of other little details and important issues. I will write the letter to the DG, but we will all raise these matters, specifically the key ones, with the DG again when we meet with her. But we're also trying to issue some kind of statement from here as well. I think there was some coverage that we would have received from the media that's helpful. But we'll also issue a formal statement, basically making these points that we've made around the delay. That's the key thing to make. Okay, thank you very much. Then I understand there is lunch, probably getting a little bit late, in the new wing. So all of you are more than welcome. It's on the second floor new wing. Other members will direct you to it. I might have to be excused if I'm... We'll try to work on the statement a little bit so that we get it out from...